You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Michael Knox, who is an emeritus distinguished university professor at the University of South Florida, chair of the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation, and editor of the U.S. Peace Registry. His anti-war activities began in 1965 in opposition to the war in Vietnam. As a delegate to the 20th National Student Congress, he introduced a successful resolution to hold an anti-war demonstration in August of 67 in front of the White House. In 1970, Michael Knox co-founded a draft counseling center, and in 1971, he blew the whistle on classified Department of so-called defense weapons research at the University of Michigan. Since then, he has continued to engage in anti-war actions. Dr. Knox founded the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation in 2005 to honor Americans who stand for peace. Take a look at uspeacememorial.org. Michael Knox, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much, David, for having me. It's a great honor to be on your show.
I should have had you on long before, have been in touch and known of your work for years, but learned some new things from that bio I just read. Wonderful work you've been doing. Tell us briefly, for those who don't know, what is the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation and what is it trying to accomplish?
Well, it's a 501c3 not-for-profit public charity. Its goal is to honor Americans who stand for peace as a way of changing our culture. As you well know, based on all your writings and all your scholarly work that I've read, our nation is a nation of war. It began in war, has a long history of waging war from the native peoples decimated by the U.S. Army to recent bombings of poor people and underdeveloped Middle Eastern and African countries. So during my lifetime, the U.S. has bombed at least 26 countries that we all know publicly, killing millions of people and maiming tens of millions more. And so since the end of World War II, no other country has killed and injured more people living outside of our borders. So clearly there's evidence of a culture of war. And part of sustaining that culture of war is to honor the soldiers. War is glorified in our culture. If you don't turn on the TV, you attend an athletic event, even go to a school or public meeting where you don't hear them honoring the military. And, of course, that reinforces warrior behavior. We have monuments to wartime presidents, memorials in Washington to wars, those who have served and died in wars, the military and people who are on the side of war, they receive medals, promotions, ceremonies, even vanity license plate discounts at Kmart and Home Depot. On the other side of the coin, people who have opposed war publicly often suffer severe consequences. They may be arrested, tear gassed, pepper sprayed. They certainly don't receive a salary for their work. In fact, they may lose income, lose friends, lose jobs, promotions, be beaten by the police, imprisoned, you know, all kinds of negative consequences. So our society has the weight on supporting the warrior. That's our American hero. And if you listen to President Obama over 8 years and President Trump, they see someone in uniform in the audience, they will point them out, ask them to stand, say they're a true American hero, the best our nation has to offer, and thank you for your service. And, you know, everyone applauds. And one might ask, why aren't we recognizing teachers, healthcare providers, parents, volunteers, farmers, government employees, you know, service providers of all kinds, especially advocates for peace? So So the purpose of the foundation really is to balance the picture a little bit. If we wish to move towards a culture of peace, we must recognize and honor the peacemakers.
Very well said. Michael Knox couldn't possibly agree more, and I think it's one of the most important things to be working on. So you've been at the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation. You've been up and running for 13 years or so. What have you been working on?
Well, we have three projects, and two of the three are already successfully moving forward in our efforts. Our efforts are nationwide to honor Americans who stand for peace. We do that by publishing the U.S. Peace Registry, which is a publication that's online but will be a book next year. We award an annual Peace Prize, and we're planning for the U.S. Peace Memorial as a national monument in Washington, D.C. And I guess during this interview, I'd like to talk about all three of those projects. Specifically, and answer any questions you might have.
Absolutely, and I apologize that my telephone just rang. the U.S. Peace Registry, let's start with that one.
All right, well, the registry recognizes and documents the work of and basically honors anti-war activists because we think they can help adjust our culture by inspiring more Americans to speak out for peace. So we honor both individuals, Americans, and American U.S. organizations. And we think that by honoring them, that we will create role models, and that these role models people might look at in the future. If people are disturbed by a particular war, maybe not war in general, but a particular war they think is wrong, they might decide to do something, but they might not have any idea what to do, what kind of activities to engage in. So in the Peace Registry, they can find individuals they might relate to. For example, you might be in the trades, and you might see someone who is described as a plumber in Detroit, Michigan, with four grandchildren. That's how they describe themselves. And under that, activities that they've engaged in. So knowing who that person is and in real life, and they're similar to you, maybe you might feel comfortable engaging in these activities. So it's the role model aspect. And then the second aspect is, what specific behaviors do these people engage in? And we're actually collecting quite a list. It'll be well over 400 specific behaviors, a broad range, everything from writing a letter to the editor in your local newspaper in opposition to a particular war, or to propose a peaceful solution to an international crisis. Everything from the letter to the editor to civil disobedience, chaining yourself to the gates of the White House, or blocking entrance to a public hearing in Congress for which you're arrested. So it's a broad range. Some people feel more comfortable with civil disobedience, others don't. But it's meant to be a guide for others. So we want to honor people, recognize them, hold them up as role models, and then describe in behaviorally specific terms what they do. So in the Peace Registry, if you look at it by going to uspeacememorial.org and clicking on U.S. Peace Registry, the individual section, you'll see each action is bolded the first time that we present it in a person's listing. So, I have yours up on the screen right now, David, and, there's a one-sentence description of who you are. You've received a master's degree from the University of Virginia in philosophy, that you're an author, an activist, a journalist, a blogger, a radio host, and you live in Charlottesville. So that's one sentence. And then under that, we have the specific activities you've engaged in. And frankly, you're a tremendous hero of mine, looking at all of these things that you've done. I'm certainly sure that there have been some negative consequences to you personally, financially or physically or emotionally for doing some of these things. But, we appreciate them. And looking at all the places you've been an invited speaker at, you've been a board member, you've been an advocate. I mean, things like that recent activity I think you did a couple of years ago, the resolution in your city council regarding in opposition to the war in Iran or starting a war with Iran, the anti-drone resolution. I mean, that's an idea that very few people would think of, actually going to the local government and trying to get the government to take a stand on something.
Right.
But then, you know, you've got, you know, your online course you developed on ending war, your faculty status, all the books you've authored, radio and TV interviews, the organizations you've started. It's just a huge list.
It's a huge project. You're talking about one person, and there are a lot of people, even just in this one little country, and they constantly have to be updated as they change where they're living and what they're doing. But it's an admirable project, an incredibly valuable project that every peace organization and individual ought to be assisting in. Conscious of time, you said three things you wanted to talk about. Another one that I recall was a peace memorial, a peace monument.
Well, as I said, there are three things, and two of them we've accomplished. They exist, and people can participate in them. The second one that does exist is the Peace Prize, which we give annually, and just to read off, you know, a few of the people that have won this prize over the years. It started in 2009 with Cindy Sheehan, recognized for her anti-war activism. Your old colleague and boss, Dennis Kucinich, in 2010. Noam Chomsky in 2011. Medea Benjamin in 2012. Chelsea Manning. In fact, the quote on the plaque for Chelsea Manning is kind of interesting. It says, "For conspicuous bravery at the risk of her own freedom above and beyond the call of duty." And then in Code Pink was our first organization to win the award in 2014. The Honorable Kathy Kelly in 2015. And Veterans for Peace, the second organization, and the Honorable Anne Wright in 2017. So we have, you know, some distinguished people that have won the Peace Prize, and that continues. Our founding members are the people who nominate these each year. Last year we had 11 nominations for the Peace Prize, and it's a growing thing with more and more interest every year. And being considered for that.
Well, they are all friends of mine, apart from organizations, mm-hmm. I guess, can't be friends of mine. So not just Dennis Kucinich.
Well, you're a friend of Code Pink, I'm sure.
Well, certainly. And Chelsea Manning I have actually worked with but do not know well and have actually mm-hmm. not met in person ever. But the rest of them are all friends of mine, and I think very deserving. And, you know, when someone like Barack Obama receives the Nobel Peace Prize and says, "I can think of lots of people more deserving than myself," I agree with him.
Absolutely right.
I would start with the list that have received the U.S. Peace Prize from you. That's indeed the list of people who ought to be getting credit and encouragement. And I think actually it's very enjoyable to work for peace, and the emotional damage of not doing so would be far greater. And we shouldn't discourage people by suggesting it's unpleasant or something. But
there are consequences. You have to be brave, and that's what we're trying to show, that not only is it something you should feel responsible to do, but it takes some courage to do it. And we want people to feel comfortable. Many people who speak out are labeled as un-American, unpatriotic, anti-military. And so society gives you this label, and so people are reluctant to speak out. So our purpose is to highlight what people are doing so people will start understanding it's socially acceptable. It is part of our culture, our long, broad history of people having the courage to speak out against war. And so we're trying to make it more socially acceptable, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And by having people like you in the registry and these Peace Prize recipients and the hundreds of other people that are there, we're beginning to make the point that, you know, these aren't outliers. These are contributors to our society. And that's where we get into the third project, which is the one that we will be raising funds for. And that is to build a national monument called the U.S. Peace Memorial in Washington, D.C. And that monument will hopefully draw people to it. And when they arrive, they will have access to the U.S. Peace Registry. So they will see what people have done. They will have the information about the Peace Prize recipients will be on it. And it will be covered with quotations from famous Americans. And our goal is the founding members are actually choosing these right now. And we have some research librarians who are making sure the quotes are precisely accurate. But when a person comes to the monument and sees a quotation from a George Washington that's anti-war or Benjamin Franklin or other heroes of theirs, people they've read about in the history books, they'll be shocked to see that these people said some very strong anti-war statements. And they were, you know, are people labeled as true patriotic Americans. We think that can help change our culture. So
I certainly hope so.
To give you a few ideas, for example, Helen Keller, certainly not known for anti-war statements, but we have a strong statement from her that she says, strike against war, for without you, no battles can be fought. And Albert Einstein, who became an American citizen, I believe that the killing of human beings in a war is no better than common murder. So that's an example of a strong anti-war statement from an American that will shock visitors, but also help them to understand that it's okay to speak out against war, and you should speak out against war. So obviously there'll be quotes from Martin Luther King and presidents like President Eisenhower. Here's another one I'd like to read from Margaret Mead, because this really is the essence of our mission. Margaret Mead, we must devise a system in which peace is more rewarding than war. And that really gets to the jux and the focus that we're trying to achieve.
You know, here in Charlottesville, Virginia, where I live, there are famously statues of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson that people imagine are still standing because of racism. And they're actually still standing because the state of Virginia forbids taking down any war monument. And I generally say, you know, we don't have a law against taking down peace monuments. We'd also couldn't find one to take down if we searched for it. But this past week, I was out in Western Virginia, in the state of Virginia, not West Virginia, at Eastern Mennonite University, and they have this beautiful big monument called "Guns into Plowshare," and it's a giant plowshare made out of little guns, and it's a beautiful peace monument. They would be allowed to take that down. There's no law against taking that down. But if there was any war monument anywhere around, they would be forbidden to ever take it down. This seems like a serious problem in our culture, and yet there are peace monuments. What do you think your peace monument will look like?
Well, you know, the founding members will actually make a decision. Obviously, we're going to have to architects and designers and artists involved once we raise sufficient money to get to that position. Your point about there are peace memorials, there are actually very few in
yes.
Washington, our nation's capital, where so many international visitors go and children go. I mean, we can have a great impact on children who will see a monument, see people they've read about, understand that it's okay to speak out against war. Lafayette Park, where you and I have marched many times in front of the White House.
Yeah.
In that one park, I once, waiting for, a boring speaker to finish, walked around the park looking at each of the statues there. I counted 14 swords, 3 spears, and 6 cannons. You know, and if you go around Washington, there are very few monuments that are not to war, or where the individuals are not carrying a weapon, a sword,
that's
a
right.
pistol, a rifle or something. very, very few. And when you see, like, there's a Gandhi monument in front of the Indian embassy, but that's not a U.S. monument. That was, you know, paid for by the people of India. And there's an Einstein one, but there are very few that are not about war and yeah. pro-war. But our monument, back to your question, the current design is like if you were to put the peace symbol, the old nuclear disarmament type peace symbol down on the ground and then build it up one pixel at a time, moving up for a couple hundred feet, you would have a structure that would have 12 facets or facades to it. And you can see the design on the current design. I'm sure this is just preliminary. It'll be changed probably, but on uspeacememorial.org, you can see that. And there will be, the quotations will be there, plenty of room for these anti-war quotations, plus access, electronic access to the peace registry. So can you imagine, say you're 80 years old and you walk on the mall and you come up to the U.S. Peace Memorial with your grandson or granddaughter and you say, well, let's see what Grandpa did to oppose war. And you say your name and up comes your registry and the listing with all of those many activities you've engaged in over the years with links, hyperlinks, to go on and see the article you wrote or the newspaper headline or listen to the interview. All right, think you become an instant role model for that child. You know, you're a hero. You're on a national monument.
Yeah.
And when you visit the Vietnam Memorial Wall, you'll often see older generation Vietnam era men and women with younger people, and they're basically becoming heroes for those people as they talk about their comrades and the war. And that's what we need for America. We need a symbol of peace and those Americans who have spoken out against war.
It's a wonderful vision. You know, I have some friends you're probably familiar with who have been tossing around the idea of a memorial to the victims of U.S. bombing campaigns around the world,
mm-hmm.
a memorial
mm-hmm.
in D.C. And because land in D.C., especially anywhere near the mall, the central national mall, would cost a fortune, they've been sort of brainstorming with, you know, will the Methodist building or the Friends Committee on National Legislation building put something mm-hmm. on the side of their building or put a monument on the roof of their building and carry people up there and so forth. I mean, how can you possibly, you know, get land in D.C. for a memorial?
Well, I mean, they're extending, the National Park Service is extending the areas where they'll put national memorials. Obviously, the primo spot is on the mall, but there are other areas that are being developed along the Potomac. The footprint of our memorial is pretty small. And, you know, it's a matter of money as well. The Martin Luther King Memorial, I think the most recent one around, which has a very nice anti-war quote on one of the stones, that was well over $100 million. I think it was $120 million. And not only do you have to have the money to design it and build it, but you have to have sufficient funds to maintain it into perpetuity. The National, you know, Mall or any of those parks is kind of, I guess, the front porch of the nation, and they don't want things deteriorating like some of those monuments have. So there's a significant amount of money, and we have not gone public yet with our campaign to raise funds. And I think that's going to be the difficult part. We set some benchmarks that we must achieve before we go public. And one of those, or two of them actually, is that we have 1,000 founding members representing all 50 states. And at this point, we have 40 states plus Puerto Rico, the District of Columbia, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. So we're missing 10 states. That's 80% of our goal. But in terms of founding members, we only have 337. So we need 663 more of those. And, you know, we need some from these states that we're missing as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's a long haul just to get to the point where we can say in our first press release, We have 1,000 founding members representing all 50 states who are, you know, ready and willing to build this. So
you know,
it's a long process.
The U.S. Mint, we've got just a few minutes left, but I wonder, this may be completely off track and unhelpful, but, you know, the U.S. military has admits to having troops in 175 countries. I often think, given where the damage is done by the U.S. military, the world ought to have a vote in U.S. elections. I wonder why people outside, the other 94% of humanity, couldn't pitch in, wouldn't have an interest in a peace monument in Washington, D.C.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up. In our annual report, which is available on our website under the About Us thing, our 2017 annual report, this pleased report that for the first time we had contributions from other countries. We actually had three founding members, I think the UK, Switzerland, and Costa Rica, that joined us last year, and that was for the first time. And they wrote about their real concerns about the U.S. and this militarism. I mean, no other country is behaving like this or has in my lifetime. You're talking about invading, killing people from eight different countries this year. I mean, that is crazy that the world would let us get away with that. And the fact is that these countries that were killing, wounding, and making refugees of people in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, Syria, Niger, you know, These are predominantly Muslim countries that were killing children. If any other country and its allies had such a specific ethnic religious focus, the world would call it genocide. And yet we continue to do it under three presidents now, four presidents. I mean,
I'm not doing it. A government I oppose is doing it, but yeah. use the first person at your own discretion.
Yeah. Well, these wars are in our name, and you and I and the people in the registry and thousands of other Americans are speaking out, but most Americans are not, and we need to make them understand this is their war, and they have to take action. They have a responsibility to stop it.
30 seconds left, Michael Knox. Can anyone anywhere listening to this contact you at uspeacememorial.org and become a founding member?
Absolutely, uspeacememorial.org. We need volunteers. We need founding members. We need people to send us their applications to be in the registry for themselves, their organizations. They need to look at the registry. So I hope they'll look at uspeacememorial.org, consider joining us as a founding member, at least get on our listserv. There's a button for doing that. And write to me directly if you want more information at knox@uspeacememorial.org, K-N-O-X at uspeacememorial.org.
Very well said. Michael Knox is the chair of the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation. Michael, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a gun-free school is a magnet for bad people, is a real statement from the actual president in response to a horrific event in which a 19-year-old shot and killed 17 people at his former high school in Parkland, Florida, which suggests that waiting for Donald Trump to act to prevent gun violence should be no part of an effort to prevent gun violence. And if Americans really want to stop being the only country where this happens, who keeps officially claiming that there's no way to prevent it, it will require not just deep examination of the multiple roots of mass violence of this sort, but also an approach to political processes that keeps its eye on the prize of real change. We'll talk about possibilities of movement on the issue of gun control and about some of the other cultural aspects of this violence, whose examination has to be part of getting beyond this cycle of mass shootings and thoughts and prayers and more mass shootings. Lee Drutman is a senior fellow in the political reform program at New America and author of the book The Business of America is Lobbying. He wrote, Parkland could be a turning point for gun control for Vox.com. We'll also hear from Pat Elder, author of the book Military Recruiting in the United States and director of the National Coalition to Protect Student Privacy, which resists the militarization of schools. That's coming up, but first we'll take a very quick look back at recent press. Americans are worried about inequality of wealth and income, as multiple polls show. One from the New York Times and CBS a couple of years ago found a strong majority saying wealth should be more evenly divided, that it's an urgent problem, and nearly 6 in 10 Americans said government should do more to reduce the gap between the rich and the poor. Part of the reason that doesn't happen is the continued prevalence of economic commentary that relies on fantasy. Such was a recent New York Times op-ed by Yale law professor Amy Chua. The piece laments what Chua calls America's political tribalism, but claims that, though we all complain about it, we're missing its root causes— the tensions deriving from the combination of democracy and a market-dominant minority. Quote, most Americans assume that democracy and free markets go hand in hand, naturally working together to generate prosperity and freedom. For the United States, this has largely been true. But by their very nature, markets and democracy coexist in deep tension. Capitalism creates a small number of very wealthy people, while democracy potentially empowers a poor majority resentful of that wealth. Close quote. As economist Dean Baker notes dryly, the assertion that the massive inequality we're now seeing in the U.S. is the result of an unfettered market is a convenient view for those who are on the upside of things. It just also happens to be nonsense. We didn't have to make patent and copyright monopolies ever longer and stronger, allowing folks like Bill Gates to get incredibly rich. We could have made Amazon pay the same sales tax as their mom-and-pop competitors, which would mean Jeff Bezos would not be so incredibly rich. We could subject Wall Street financial transactions to the same sort of sales taxes that people pay on shoes and clothes, hugely downsizing the high incomes earned in that sector. And we could have rules of corporate governance that make it easier for shareholders to rein in CEO pay. None of the rules, Baker writes, that we have in place that redistribute upward were given to us by the market. They were the result of deliberate economic policy. It's understandable that those on the sharp end of these conscious choices would be resentful. They're likely to be even more resentful when the beneficiaries of the rigging pretend that it's all just the unbiased workings of the invisible hand. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Mass shootings like the February 14th killing of 17 people at a high school in Parkland, Florida, are actually a small fraction of gun deaths in the United States, but they hold a particular horror. And their wake, in which politicians and pundits tangle themselves in knots, arguing about the real cause and why other people's ideas for responses won't work, generates an enervating sense of frustration with the political process. The students of Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School are looking to break the stasis around gun restrictions, planning walkouts and demonstrations they don't look like fading soon. Our guest suggests that's one of the elements that might allow this mass shooting to actually spur substantive change. Lee Drutman is a senior fellow in the Political Reform Program at New America. He's author of The Business of America is Lobbying, and he teaches in the Center for Advanced Governmental Studies at Johns Hopkins University. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Lee Drutman.
Great to be with you.
On rules around access to lethal weaponry, as on many things, we kind of just want humans to just do better. You know, it feels slimy to have to think in terms of money or influence or partisanship. And yet, our lives are shaped by laws as well as culture, and laws are shaped by this political process that we've got. So what do you see looking at it dry-eyed that suggests that this might actually be a turning point for gun control?
Well, there's a few things happening here. One, as you noted, is that the students have emerged as a impressive organizational force. They are passionate, and they appear to be growing in numbers far beyond Parkland. So that's something that we haven't seen before in the wake of any of these gun events. But broader in terms of the politics, two things are happening that are related. One is that it used to be the case that the NRA was seen as being influential because there were a lot of Democrats who represented rural areas, and rural areas tend to be gun areas. And so these Democrats were afraid of challenging the NRA because they were afraid of losing those votes. But now the NRA no longer really supports any Democrats, and because there really are very few to no Democrats who represent rural areas. So the NRA has basically become a part of the Republican Party, which helps it when Republicans are in charge, but also weakens it overall as an organization. Second thing related to that is now the axis of politics is shifting so that the swing areas are upscale suburban areas like Parkland, where you have a lot of voters, particularly suburban moms, who may have been part of the Republican Party for economic reasons, but are moving to the Democratic Party for cultural reasons, and they are much more likely to care about school safety than they are about gun rights. So there's a potential for that to be a new swing constituency in our politics, which puts pressure on Republicans who hope to hold those districts to support gun control.
Well, what do you see in terms of legislation? It seems to be kind of all over the place in the states. We have laws that are making it easier to get guns. We have other laws that seem to be trying to raise some kind of hurdles or introduce steps in that process. Do you see anything meaningful in terms of actual legislation coming out of this?
Since Sandy Hook, the red states have moved to loosen gun restrictions, and blue states have moved to tighten gun restrictions, and I think we'll continue to see that. I mean, that's sort of the pulling apart of this country on the cultural dimension. The red states are more conservative on cultural issues. The blue states are more liberal on cultural issues. But, I mean, ultimately, we need national solutions to this issue. I mean, guns can travel across state lines very easily. And here, I don't know. The president has been a bit all over the place, as he often is, because it depends on who was the last person who he talked to or what, you know, occurred to him in the last 5 seconds. But ultimately, it'll depend on Congress. And I would be surprised if Congress did much right now, but there's pressure building. Unfortunately, I don't think this will be the last mass shooting that we will see. But with each event, the pressure builds. And there's more and more organizational force on behalf of gun control. I mean, one of the reasons why the NRA was so feared as an organization for a long time is because there was no organizational force mobilized on behalf of gun control. There were a lot of single-issue voters who voted on gun rights. The NRA was, you know, incredibly effective at mobilizing voters on those issues. So the conventional wisdom in Washington was you don't want to challenge the NRA. That was how people operated. But Pat Toomey, Republican senator from Pennsylvania, challenged the NRA, introduced legislation after Sandy Hook, and the NRA downgraded his rating, but Toomey still won. He won his primary. He won re-election. So he showed that you can be a Republican and you can challenge the NRA. He's now reintroducing legislation on background checks. And there were other Democrats who went along with the NRA from more conservative states and still lost. So, you know, the all-powerful NRA is less powerful than partisanship.
And some of that power, as I've heard you and others note, is really the perception of power. It's really the fact that folks think you can't cross the NRA and don't pay so much attention to what happens when someone actually does.
Well, all power is perception of power, I suppose. But if you challenge the NRA and it turns out that you're fine politically, or it doesn't matter, that shows that the NRA is a bit of a paper tiger. And I think more and more legislators will find that out as they challenge the NRA.
Well, there are people who are deeply invested in the fantasy of taking out an armed killer with their own weapon, you know, and I don't think that all the research that we have that's showing that more guns are not the answer is going to reach them necessarily, whatever Rush Limbaugh might say. He was quoted on the issue on NPR for some reason. But I understand that support for gun control or some restrictions on gun access is at its highest among the public in 10 years. And among those looking for change, I think I see people getting over the idea that you have to pick one response. You know, people are pointing towards a large menu of responses. Let's do all the things. And that's hopeful to me, rather than having to say whether I care more about domestic violence or about automatic weapons. I mean, to some extent, it's a public conversation problem, isn't it?
Certainly, public opinion seems to be moving heavily in favor of gun control, and particularly after this event, I think. There have been a series of mass shootings over the last few years, more than we've ever experienced. I mean, the frequency of mass shootings is increasing, and I think people are taking notice. And the NRA has increasingly taken on a very extreme position on this that I think ultimately undermines their broader credibility. I mean, I understand why they're doing that, and they're doing it because they're an organization that needs to continually stoke a sense of fear among its members in order to get them active and keep them donating and keep them participating, and also to keep their territory from groups even further to the right on guns. But that takes them further and further from the mainstream, and at some point, sort of Looney Tunes quality to that fantasy of everybody being armed and in constant OK Corral, you know, shoot 'em out warfare, and that I think loses a lot of reasonable people.
Well, let me just ask you finally if you have any thoughts about the way that media coverage plays a role here. Any angles you'd encourage journalists to explore or maybe to stop exploring? What are your thoughts on terms of looking at media coverage on this issue going forward?
Well, I think the more coverage of gun violence, the more people are concerned about it. One of the reasons that often we've not seen responses to the shootings is that there's a sort of cycle of media attention. You know, a few days after the shooting, things move on. Now, I think something feels different about this in that we're still talking about this a week later, which is unusual. And I think part of that has to do with the fact that these students are keeping it in the news, and there's a continued sense of conflict. But the more this stays in the news, the harder it will be for politicians to ignore.
We've been speaking with Lee Drutman. He's senior fellow in the Political Reform Program at New America, author of the book The Business of America is Lobbying. And his article, Parkland Could Be a Turning Point for Gun Control, can be found on Vox.com. Lee Drutman, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Glad to be part of the conversation. Thank you.
in the wake of lethal gun violence like that in Parkland, Florida, we talk about the specific details of this shooting and this killer, and we talk about the U.S. culture of violence, imperialist, domestic, statutory. Sometimes overlooked are what you might call the bridges between these things. What are some of the mechanisms that convey ideas about the rightness of violence and the value of weapons to individuals like the 19-year-old who killed 14 of his former classmates, two staff members, and a teacher? The young man was a member of the Army Junior Reserve Officer Training Corps program at the high school before he was expelled. He was wearing his JROTC shirt when he carried out the attack. Our guest says whatever the role here, the presence of military recruiters in high schools around the country calls out for challenge. Pat Elder is director of the National Coalition to Protect Student Privacy, which resists the militarization of schools, and author of Military Recruiting in the United States. He joins us now by phone from Maryland. Welcome to Counterspin, Pat Elder.
Thank you so much.
Well, JROTC is all around the country. They were in my high school in Maryland. They had a table set up in the lobby, as I recall. But for those who don't know about them, what is this group and how do they operate in schools?
Well, the JROTC program is part of the Army's command structure. It's part of the Cadet Command, which is the lowest item in the command structure. Now, the JROTC program is two-dimensional, as I see it. One, it stresses the physical aspect of being a soldier. And in that capacity, they put lethal weapons into the hands of 13-year-old ninth graders. But there's also a much less studied and understood dimension, and that has to do with the ideology that is taught by the program. And so each of the four branches has its own cadet command structure. The Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Marines each have 4 years of textbooks that the students learn from. And each of the states have accommodated the JROTC program by allowing students to substitute core curricular items. For instance, in Florida, students can substitute biology, physical science, physical education, and art if they want to take the JROTC program.
What's some of this ideology that you're talking about?
Well, you'd have to read it to get a firm understanding of it, and it's easy enough to do. Simply Google Army JROTC textbook, and you'll pull up a high school in Alabama or Minnesota, and they'll have links to, in this case, the Army's JROTC textbooks. So just to give you a little idea, as far as government instruction is concerned, the unit on civics is entitled You the People. Now, I learned it in Maryland as We the People. Children are taught to respect authority, and they are taught to get in line, and they are taught to not question authority. That's why they call it You the People. And that's civics. Keep in mind that the state of Florida, or other states, I should say, actually allow students to substitute JROTC for civics. But perhaps even more insidious is the way United States history is taught. It's taught in such a way that might makes right. The United States is imminently the greatest power in the world. Students are taught that as the United States grew, it was correct in doing what it did and justified. For instance, in Hiroshima, we dropped the atomic bomb, and JROTC students are taught that this was justified because it saved a million American lives. Meanwhile, we have leading academics in the country, including Maryland's own Gar Alperovitz and Peter Kuznick from Bethesda, who turned that argument upside down and saying that the Japanese were ready to surrender. American textbooks generally are coming around to that view, but I'll give you another example. An innocent United States warship was off the coast of North Vietnam and was fired on by the North Vietnamese in the Gulf of Tonkin, and that's what precipitated the Vietnamese War. And so history is taught that way. It's taught that we are right and that we have might, and it's good that we're right, and it's good that we have might.
Well, this kind of blinkered view of history is obviously substantively important, but as important, I would say, maybe, is the methods. I mean, in your book, Military Recruiting in the United States, you outline the way that Jay Rotsey operates in schools, which is not to say, hey, we're here, we have an idea, if you're interested, come over and talk to us. It's much more insidious than that.
Well, it really is. Although the cadet command makes it clear that students are not to be mandatorily placed into the program. We have examples across the country where ninth graders are placed into the program without parental consent. It should also be noted here that individual soldiers who teach the Jay Rotsey program are retired military, and most do not have college educations. So in the state of Maryland, where I was a licensed social studies teacher, I was required to take 52 hours of teacher accreditation programs. These folks waltz into the schools without the credentials.
Folks have been asking about the connection to the NRA. They're connected, but it's not in terms of giving money. What is the connection between Jay Rotsey programs and the NRA?
Well, I think the focus, rather than being on the NRA, should be on its proxy, the CMP. And the CMP is a little-known, congressionally mandated organization. It was set up in 1903. It's the Civilian Marksmanship Program. After the Spanish-American War in 1898, military planners were shocked that American youth just couldn't shoot as straight as they'd hoped. And so Congress instituted this program in order to teach children how to shoot. And that program exists to today. The Civilian Marksmanship Program regulates the Jay Rotsey Marksmanship Program. Oftentimes, when schools are having difficult times keeping their program afloat, CMP will communicate with the NRA, and grants will be filled out, and the individual Jay Rotsey programs will be outfitted with guns and ammunition. But I'd also like, before we're done, to speak about the lead that's associated with the pellets that are used. The guns that the children shoot fire .177 caliber lead pellets, as opposed to the size of a .22 bullet. So these are lethal weapons. When the pellet exits the barrel at the muzzle end of the rifle, tiny lead particulate matter goes into the air and falls to the floor. And that lead particulate matter also explodes at the target and accumulates on the floor. And so the Civilian Marksmanship Program has a publication called the Guide to Lead Management. And that guide plays down the significance of airborne lead, basically relying on science produced by a firm of one individual in Colorado, claims that there is no airborne lead. But this is bogus science. That individual was cited by Colorado authorities for inaccurate reporting, and he was disciplined by the Colorado state authorities for an entire host of incorrect reporting. And we have German and Swedish studies that show that if only pellet guns are used, that there is airborne lead and that the shooters experience elevated blood lead levels. The Civilian Marksmanship Program does admit that there is a large amount of lead particulate matter deposited at the muzzle end and at the target end, and they simply suggest that students wash their hands when they're done firing. However, NIOSH, N-I-O-S-H, says that that's not enough, that you cannot get the residue off of your hands. Civilian Marksmanship Program tells high schools that they should use trisodium phosphate in order to wash the floors, but it is a poisonous chemical that the Housing and Urban Development has said should never be used because of its destructive impact on the environment. So these guys are out of step, and more focus needs to be on the civilian marksmanship program as far as the lead is concerned.
What is it that you would like folks to keep in mind as JROTC comes up, perhaps in the context of this coverage of this Parkland shooting?
Well, first of all, it's a numbers game. There are 565,000 children that are in the JROTC program. That's all four branches. The military is attempting to put as many adolescent fingers around as many triggers as possible. They understand the impact, the psychological lure of firing a weapon. So the Army gets it. They understand that the children love to shoot, whether it's virtual or real. And so they use that psychological element to lure the children in. And so it's only a matter of time and a matter of numbers. When you have so many children that are that young having guns put in their hands, these types of incidents are bound to happen.
Pat Elder is the director of the National Coalition to Protect Student Privacy. They're online at studentprivacy.org. He's also author of the book Military Recruiting in the United States. Pat Elder, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Well, thanks so much for the opportunity.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and their transcripts on FAIR's website, fair.org. That's also the place to sign up for FAIR's newsletter, Extra. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shop with Alex Smith.
On October 11th, 2016, five climate activists shut down every pipeline carrying tar sands crude from Canada to the United States. One of them, Michael Foster, is in the state penitentiary in Bismarck, North Dakota. We will talk to the other four as they await their sentencing, and they will give the defense that so far no court has allowed them to tell a jury of their peers.
The valve turners.
World politicians barely pretend to contain the carbon monster that threatens our future. Scientists warn us, bankers and investors continue to finance the deadly game. But what if we just turn off the taps? Enter the valve turners. These are the people who cannot wait for the system to fail on climate. Their target? Tar sands oil, the most carbon-expensive fossil fuel process on the planet. In Alberta, megacorporations boil or strip mine countless square miles of Canadian land and forest. The Aboriginal people suffer. We have no time to discuss those companies' toxic emissions entering the rivers, land, and air. If you could turn that pipeline off, would you? Some do. We're going to talk with them to hear their voices from the front.
Radio EcoShock.
The Valve Turners.
The first defendant charged with defending the Earth, of course, is Leonard Higgins. After retiring with his job from the government of Oregon, Leonard co-founded 350corvallis.org in Corvallis, home to Oregon State University. In 2013, Higgins was part of a direct action against the tar sands. Well, I'll ask him about that. After another action on October 11, 2016, he was found guilty of shutting down the Spectra Energy Express pipeline in Montana. Leonard Higgins, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Glad to be here.
You worked for 31 years for the Oregon government. Frankly, you look like kind of an average guy. You could be my neighbor. What woke you up to social justice for the climate threat?
So it was a gradual thing. It's rooted in my upbringing in church and a sense of right and wrong that I was brought up with in my family. The thing that really brought me around the corner, though, was a workshop that I attended in 2007. It was called The Work That Reconnects. It's a lifelong work of Joanna Macy. And it describes the need for us to do exactly the challenge in front of us, and that's to change from an industrial growth society to a life-sustaining civilization. And the most impactful part of that workshop was what Joanna calls facing our pain for the world. It's part of the spiral. She has folks start out in gratitude, really getting in touch with all the wonderful things that we're blessed with in this world. And then with that foundation to really start looking at what's wrong. And I think all of us know, even those that are in strong denial, that there's a lot wrong. And there's a grieving that actually gave me a lot of energy to actually begin doing something about what's wrong.
Tell us about the earlier action in Anacortes, Washington.
So you'd mentioned the tar sands related one, and that was in 2013. That was blocking what's called a mega load. It's prefabricated equipment that was bound for the tar sands in Alberta. The action in 2016, I think it was May of 2016 in Anacortes, Washington, was part of the worldwide effort coordinated by 350.org to demonstrate the need to keep 80% of the fossil fuel reserves in the ground. There were about 5,000 folks involved in that event. And the part that I was involved in, there were about 300 of us at one point camping on the tracks, blocking oil train cars carrying crude oil to the refineries there, Tesoro and a Shell refinery. It was actually the most wonderful sense of community there on the tracks, people that are willing to put their bodies on the line to stop the harm that's being done.
And where does the dirty oil in the Spectra Express pipeline come from, and where does it go?
It comes from the huge tar sands mining operation in Alberta, Canada, and flows along the Canadian border to the west and comes down into Montana. And it's carrying tar sands crude through Montana and to the south to refineries where it's refined into various products. It was one of five tar sands pipelines. All of the tar sands pipelines coming into the U.S. from Canada that our group shut down that day, it represented about 15% of the U.S. use of crude oil.
And what did you do in Montana? Was it hard?
Yeah, that's kind of a funny question. It was very difficult. I spent my life as a law-abiding person. You know, I was taught that my right to do what I wanted ended at the nose of someone else's rights to do what they wanted and not to infringe on others' rights. So I'm the last person to consider trespassing on someone else's property, touching their equipment. On the other hand, I do anything, and I am doing all I can to protect my kids' future and to protect my kids and my loved ones' safety. And so it was hard. It wasn't until I actually finished shutting down the valves after we'd called the pipeline company ahead of time, and they'd basically already shut down the flow by shutting down the pumping stations, that I closed the valve. It wasn't until then that I really breathed a sigh of relief, both in terms of doing what I could to stop the harm and also holding up my end of the work with the group of us We were able to successfully shut down all five of the pipelines within an hour.
Were you the only one arrested at this particular action in Montana?
I was surprised that I was not the only one. In retrospect, I think it was kind of naive to think that with the amount of repression on protests now underway in the U.S., that the person, Reed Ingle, that came with me to live stream the action, we live streamed for two reasons. One, if there was any question by the pipeline company that we were there at their block site and prepared to shut the valve, we wanted to be able to direct them to our website so they could see that we were there and identify their own block valve site. And then secondarily, this was planned from the beginning as a very public act of nonviolent civil disobedience to draw attention to the need not only to stop new fossil fuel infrastructure, but also to scale back to begin reducing our current use of fossil fuels, reduce the carbon emissions that are creating the climate chaos that we're experiencing.
In court, were you allowed to raise the grave threat of the climate coming from tar sands oil? Could you bring that up?
No, that was very frustrating. We can talk later about the delight that I have in the allowance of what's called the climate necessity defense in the case of the Minnesota valve turners. But first, Judge Boucher in Fort Benton, Montana, denied my motion to be able to bring the climate necessity defense to talk about the threat that we all face. And he denied it without a hearing. Denied it, I think, with very little consideration. And then in court, I had a legal right to talk about my intent, the way the statute reads for the felony criminal mischief charge that I was being tried on, is that I have to have the intent to create criminal mischief, to do damage greater than $1,500 is the threshold in Minnesota. But each time that I talked about climate change, that I attempted to talk about the climate science, particularly the work of Dr. James Hansen, the prosecutor objected, and I was prevented from really talking about my intent, and very much I was prevented from talking to the jury and the judge about the threat of climate change and why I did what I did. And so those will be key factors in our appeal of the conviction. The appeal, again, is not to get off from the consequences of the civil disobedience. It's to draw attention to the problem. And I hope reach other parents like myself who should by now know that their kid's future is threatened. Or for that matter, their kid's present is threatened. And I know, like me, they'd do anything to protect their kids.
And this isn't just a human story about human impacts. I mean, I love the wild. I think you do, too. And all that innocence is threatened by our addiction to fossil fuels, especially the dirtiest ones. How do you feel about that, Leonard Higgins?
Well, it makes me want to cry, frankly. And the thing that most of us haven't realized is that we're all connected, whether it's human life or the rest of the ecosystems, animals and plants, and that our lives are interrelated. Our human lives and human civilization depend on the ecosystems in a way that we just have not been in touch with. So as we clear the forests around the planet, as we clear the natural ecosystems, as more and more species disappear, we're threatening our own lives. And all of it is precious. I feel as sad about the threat to human civilization. We've learned so much in the thousands of years that we've been in existence. We still demonstrate, of course, our human arrogance and human ignorance every day, and in the way that we're interacting and the way that our countries are posturing towards each other. But there's so much that's precious in our libraries and in the history of our own United States. The ideals that this country were founded on if we could live by them, are very precious to me. So, yeah, it makes me want to cry.
When is your sentencing, and what do you expect will happen, Leonard?
I will receive my sentence from Judge Boucher on March 20 in Fort Benton, Montana. And the maximum that I would receive is 10 years in prison, a $50,000 fine, and court decreed restitution of some thousands of dollars. And it's really uncertain. The judge has complete discretion. Some states have mandatory guidelines that might limit what the judge sentences, but that's not the case in Montana. And so there's room for the politics of the situation to influence the judge. It's, of course, my only felony conviction. And so that the judge definitely has to take that into account. There was a pre-sentencing report done that talks about my background and excellent character and that I present no risk to community. And so it seems very unlikely that the judge could sentence me more than a couple of years. And I'm hopeful that I might receive a deferred sentence in community service, similar to Ken Ward, Washington State Valve Turner, his sentence.
What message would you like to pass on to our listeners?
I think that I'll mention my dear friend and fellow Valve Turner, Michael Foster, who just began serving a year sentence for closing the valve in North Dakota. He's in the North Dakota State Penitentiary in Bismarck, North Dakota. Michael has spent something like the last 7 or 8 years talking to primarily college and high school students about the threat of climate change. He adapted the climate reality presentation that Al Gore and that group created for the younger audience. He also founded a group that began in Germany. He founded a U.S. chapter in Washington State called Plant for the Planet. And he's literally talked to something on the order of 12 to 14,000 young people and adults about the threat of climate change. And his plea to folks as he went into the state penitentiary is that they plant trees. If we follow Dr. James Hansen's plan for getting back to a stable climate, for protecting our children, we need to reduce the carbon emissions somewhere between 8 and 10% per year. We've waited so long, it could have been on the 4 to 6% range if we would have started back when Dr. James Hansen first communicated the threat in that plan. It's now 8 to 10%. And we need to plant globally at least a trillion trees. The problem is that we've got 100 and perhaps as much as 150 gigatons of carbon in the atmosphere that over the next 30 to 40 years will drive the temperature up so that the Earth can no longer support our species and our civilization. And so if we can pull that carbon out with that trillion trees and bring the parts per million to the 350, that is what can support a stable climate, as well as begin reducing our annual carbon emissions. We have a chance to save our children's future.
I talked to a scientist on Radio EcoShock who said that when trees first began to spread all over the Earth, they did in fact lower the CO2 level and increase the amount of polar ice. So there is some hope. It is a reasonable explanation. I know Dr. James Hansen wanted to testify for Michael Foster, but was not allowed to speak. There's been a lot of muzzling throughout this whole legal system. Our guest has been Leonard Higgins of Oregon. He is a valve turner. Thank you so much, Leonard, for talking with us.
Thank you, Alex.
The Valve Turners.
When I think about the coming climate chaos, I call out, where are the artists? And here they are in action. Emily Johnson is a poet and essayist based out of Seattle, Washington. She published the book Her Animals in 2015 from Hummingbird Press. Emily Johnson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
What tar sands pipeline did you help shut down?
Annette Clapstein and I were in Leonard, Minnesota, shutting off Enbridge, two Enbridge pipelines, line 4 and line 67.
How did you learn where they were or what to do?
We, as a group, did quite a lot of research in the months leading up to this action. We wanted to make sure that we knew exactly what we were doing and that it would be safe. And, you know, there was a fair amount of scouting done, not by me personally, but by my friends. And, yeah, so basically a lot of research, both online and in person.
The media in both the United States and Canada, and there was media in Canada, of course, they're our tar sands, so to speak. But they all managed to put that word dangerous in their headlines. Was this a dangerous action?
So I have a standard response to that, which is, you know, this is something, we were very concerned about, first and foremost, the actual safety of it. And then, of course, also this accusation of doing something dangerous. But there are three main responses that we have to that. The first one up is that these are the emergency shutoff valves. So if, you know, it is a problem, these are designed and these are put in places where they're accessible to first responders, for example, not necessarily pipeline people, in case there's a wildfire or a threat of terrorism or something like that. They are designed to shut this equipment down safely. And as I believe you know, we also made multiple calls to the pipeline companies so that they could shut them down remotely, which they also do. And so if they prefer to do it that way, if that's safer to do it that way, we gave them the ability to do it that way. And in fact, all of them, it turns out, chose to do that at different moments, after a certain length of time with us turning the valves. And we, there was a pipeline safety expert who testified at Leonard's trial in Montana, made it very clear that this is what, and I believe the companies themselves referred to it as an unplanned controlled shutdown. And they do these on a regular basis, for one reason or another. So there was nothing unsafe about it. And we took great, great care to make sure of that. The other thing is that it is the only reason that I was still nervous going into the action is that I don't trust the maintenance of these companies. These companies regularly have spills in the normal course of their operations. And in fact, between 99 and 2010, Enbridge had a spill on average every, I think it was 4.5, possibly 5 days. And those were the self-reported spills. So I'm sure there were some small ones that didn't make it into that counting. So it is the daily operation of these pipelines. It is the use of them, not the shutting off of them, that is dangerous. And then the other thing is that the most important thing to remember is we know exactly how dangerous not shutting off these pipelines is in terms of climate change. They're catastrophic. Tar sands, as I'm sure you're well aware, like coal, is the worst of the worst of fossil fuels. And it's the form of oil about which Jim Hansen said it's game over for the climate if we keep developing the tar sands. So we simply have to stop the use of the worst fossil fuels in the very, very, very near future, not decades. Ideally, not even, years, but months. And, and coal is struggling on its own for a variety of reasons that have nothing to do with actually environmental regulations. It's, largely about economics. And tar sands, unfortunately, that's not true of that yet. But we need to stop using them, flat out.
In a meeting of supporters talking about direct action, you said you went through a door and was never able to come out. That's in that video. It's an excellent video on YouTube. If people just look for valve turners on YouTube, they'll find that. And it's a great meeting. Talk to us about that.
The truth is, having a deep understanding of climate change and of the urgency of climate change, that is actually really the door through which you cannot come out. You cannot ever go back through that door. When you understand what the threats are at this moment in time, then you can't unthink those thoughts. You can't unknow that, and it changes your life. And for me, what that meant, was and still means is that I devote my life to trying to fight the causes of climate change on a daily basis. And 99% of that is wholly legal. I help turn people out for hearings and write letters to their representatives and, make phone calls and, just about everything you can think of in terms of old-fashioned political organizing and protest and so forth. We do that. That's how I spend my days every single day, of the year. But it's also clear that that's not getting us where we need to get because the urgency of climate change is so drastic. And we know that, last June, Cristina Figueres, the former UN climate chief, looking at, you know, a consensus opinion by many, many, many scientists working with the UN said that we have less than 3 years to ensure that the catastrophes that we've already started to see are not irreversible. And other scientists have said other things. I've heard 2 years as well, and obviously we're already coming up on her number, meaning 2 years, so almost heading towards June again. And so we really have very little time before we set off mechanisms. You know, we've probably already set off some feedback loops that we won't be able to control. But, you know, with every day that passes now, we are running the risk of setting off others that would make it impossible for us to stop the processes of the Earth and its atmosphere that would doom most life on Earth. You know, we know right now that the, you know, basically our options are, you know, we might lose hundreds of millions of people and 5 or 10% of the biodiversity on the planet. That is probably the best case scenario, tragically. But we also know at the other end, it's, you know, the last time greenhouse gases overwhelmed the planet, it was the end Permian extinction, the worst that ever happened. It was 95% of life on the planet died out. And obviously, you know, somewhere in that range, humans will be among the missing. And this is not tinfoil hat stuff. This is stuff that scientists have been trying to tell us for years. And, you know, how fast it's coming, like, you know, obviously we don't, that's not going to start happening in 3 years. I mean, it will start happening in 3 years. It's already started happening. But the effects of it will not be complete for in the next couple of years. So we have to stop now in order to make sure that we save as many humans and as many species as we can over the course of the next 100 years or so, because we have to be on a path back to climate stability, or, you know, basically all hope is lost in the most overwhelming and really unimaginable sort of ways. And, you know, you and I probably won't see that, but our kids will certainly see it and suffer, and people all over the world are already suffering. And people in Puerto Rico, you know, I believe it's 500,000 people still don't have power, and this is in the United States. It's completely crazy, you know. And obviously that's not the worst of it either. There are the Syria, Yemen, other countries, low-lying Pacific islands. It is already existential in many, many places, and it will be existential for everybody. So we have to do what we can. We have to step up to this moment in time. And that's the door you can't go back, because once I understood the depth of what we were facing, I also understood that I had to do everything I could to prevent it. And usually that means taking legal action of many, many kinds and a lot of time, a lot of energy and love. But also it does mean civil disobedience sometimes, because really throughout, you know, the last couple hundred years anyway, and maybe before that, who knows, nonviolent civil disobedience has been the only thing that has caused rapid, deep changes to systems that seemed completely and totally stuck. So whether you're talking about the abolitionists, whether you're talking about the civil rights movement, slavery, I mean, you know, any number of things, so the suffrage, the way to get deep change in society in many ways is to just completely resist the system nonviolently in a way that other people can identify with. And they may not understand it when they first see it. Like, why would you do a thing like that? Why would you risk going to prison for years? But that opens up a moment where you get to tell them why you would do that and why, frankly, you think they should too. And so it's really about unsticking the system and making sure that people understand what the risks are of this moment so that they can act in some way rationally in response as well, you know, and whether that's kicking out their climate-denying electeds or whether it's engaging in civil disobedience, understanding that they have to have changes to their that they'll see changes to their daily lives, you know, many of which I think will greatly improve them, you know, that life without fossil fuels will be a much healthier sort of life if we manage to make it happen.
Can we call out to other artists to help get this message through?
We can call it to everybody. Yeah, this needs to be communicated in every way there is to communicate it. And you know, artists obviously have a really important role to play. I'm feeling sort of hesitant in my response because I'm actually not really writing these days because I'm so focused on this work. And, you know, with luck, I can find a little more balance on that soon. Yeah, everybody is needed in every way. And so people may or may not find a powerful way to express this in their art, but they can also, you know, help make art for protests and banner drops and things like that, and they can engage with their communities just like everybody else can engage with their communities and, you know, have a different kind of voice. And I think it's really important that we have everybody's voice in this fight, because we all have the same things at stake, even though, you know, many of us in the global north and with some measure of privilege don't face the same immediate risks. And over the longer term, you know, everybody's voice is really important.
Do you think the threat of prison and long-term trials has helped or hurt your mental health?
I would say both. You know, taking action at this level and risking time in prison was very important for my mental health, because doing something, stepping up in that way and doing something that I believe in so deeply and trying to shake up the system in a way that's different from the way that I try to do that every day, that's super important to my moral self in this moment in time. And so there's been a way in which it's been deeply satisfying. It has also been exhausting. You know, I feel very exposed. I'm a very private person, and I've had to be very public in response to this. And, you know, I've written articles. We've had articles written about us. We have to give these talks, and we have to do fundraisers. And, of course, it's also, I want to do it because it is about helping people understand why we would do this. But I do find it psychologically exhausting. And I've been doing that, you know, as I said, at the same time as I'm doing all the work I'm doing with 350 Seattle. And so, yeah, so in that way, it's been hard for my mental health, but it's been good for my moral health and my sense of purpose.
As we have to wrap up, is there any short message you'd like to leave with all our listeners?
Yeah, I guess one of the things I say sometimes is simply, you know, think about, like, when you're old or when you're dying, you know, whether you have kids or not, what would you wish you had done in this moment? We're not going to get these months back, these months and these next couple of years. And so think about what you can give and what kind of time and energy you can expend. And people often worry and feel hopeless and think it's too late, but it's never too late to say something, first of all. And second of all, at this moment in time, those of us who have any time to give and any, you know, energy, the risk of arrest, if we're in a position to do that, all of those things are so important. And now is really the moment.
Thank you so much, Emily. We've been talking with Emily Johnson, writer, poet, and valve turner, currently before the courts in Minnesota. We really appreciate what you're doing.
Yeah, thanks very much, Alex. Take care.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Ken Ward has been an environmental activist for decades. He led the public interest research group movement both in New Jersey and nationally. He was deputy executive director of Greenpeace USA and president of the National Environmental Law Center. Now he is a valve turner. Ken Ward, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
It's great to talk to you. Let me know, where did this idea to shut off the tar sands pipes come from?
It came from Canada. Folks in Montreal area were the first to do this, and they recorded their efforts, and we were able to watch that on YouTube, and that's where the idea came from.
YouTube really passes on a lot of things. In fact, there are YouTubes of people actually doing the action that you were arrested for, shutting off the tar sand pipelines.
Exactly. I mean, we did it partly to record what we were doing, but we also did it as a safety measure. Because in at least one example in Canada, when the folks called the pipeline company to say that they were going to do it, the pipeline company didn't believe them. So we thought, well, we'll just live stream what we're doing. And if there's any question, we can direct them to our Facebook page and they can look at it.
What pipeline did you turn off and how did it go?
Well, personally, I turned off the Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain Pipeline, which runs from Alberta down to Anacortes in Washington in the U.S. To do that, I had to cut a lock off a chain link fence and walk onto the property, cut another lock off a chain that was closing the safety block valve, and then manually close the valve. It didn't take very long.
Michael Foster said it was rather difficult to turn the valve that he was with. It kind of tired him out and took quite a few turns.
Yeah, I've heard him say that. And if you watch the video, you can see that it was a considerable amount of effort on his part. There was a variety of valves and how they operate and how the gearing is and what the volume going through the pipeline is, and his was definitely more difficult.
Yeah, there's a river of oil running under the ground there, and to stop it, that takes some force. And what happens? Does the oil just back up back to where it was coming from?
Well, the intention on our part certainly was to essentially get the pipeline companies themselves to shut down the pipeline electronically from their command center. And that happened. It actually happened in Michael's case as well, but it took them, that particular pipeline company took the longest to do so. So that is ideal. It is what happened in all of our cases. If that doesn't happen, then mechanically you're closing a gate inside the pipeline. That will alert the company, which will then take measures to close down the whole line.
Who was arrested with you, Ken?
Well, in my case, I had nobody in support. I did have an independent documentary film crew, Lindsay Grisel and Carl Levine, who were there documenting, and they were both actually arrested. Lindsay has since completed a movie about that action and other works that I've done, which actually opens this week in Missoula, called The Reluctant Radical. In that document, you can see, you know, her own experiences as well as mine of being arrested. She was initially charged with exactly the same set of charges that I was. They eventually were dropped, but it was a harrowing experience for them.
Will we eventually be able to find The Reluctant Radical online, do you think?
Right now, I guess the way these things work, it's opening at various festivals, film festivals. I think it's in 4 or 5. And then afterwards, there will be community screenings. And I think eventually the intention is that it will be available online, yes.
So, Ken Ward, you worked with Greenpeace at one point, and I recall the days when the CNN media mogul Ted Turner helped fund the Ruckus Society, and they trained people for direct actions. Do you think the scene for direct action is any better now than it was in the 1990s?
Well, first of all, the need is far higher because we're facing, in climate change, we're facing an existential threat, in Dr. Jim Hansen's words, the conditions that make civilization possible on a very short timeline. We need to be doing direct action as well as multiple other kinds of civic activity at a far higher level than we are currently doing it. And we're trying to do this in incredibly difficult political times, especially inside the U.S., where there's a wealth of things happening politically and climate is, you know, barely in the conversation.
In a public meeting, you suggested that your friends working in environmental organizations are in a greater existential pain, perhaps, than you are. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think that to do a lot of the day-to-day work that environmentalists, especially in mainstream organizations, are doing, you have to deny reality in a not dissimilar way to just flat-out climate deniers are doing. You have to believe that the very small incremental steps that you are engaging in can somehow actually address the problem, and that's just not true. And I think at some deep level, people understand that, and that causes a great deal of pain. I wish it was enough pain to change people's behaviors and organizational agendas, but so far that hasn't happened.
Were you allowed to express the reasons for your action in court?
I was tried twice with 2 trials. The first trial ended in a hung jury, and then the second trial I had a hung jury on 1 charge and was convicted on the other. In both cases, the judge allowed me personally to explain on the stand why I did what I did, and he allowed me to discuss a little bit the science and the geophysical basis for the need for action. I was not, however, allowed to put experts on the stand, and I wasn't allowed, or my lawyers were not allowed, to offer to the jury what's called a necessity defense, where we could have told the jury that it was appropriate for them to find me innocent, given the circumstances. And we're appealing. I'm asking for a 3rd trial where I would be allowed to offer a necessity defense.
So where are you right now in the legal machinery? Are you expecting a sentence? What's going on?
I was sentenced, convicted and sentenced last June. I was given 32 days, 2 of which I had already served, and then allowed to complete the rest through community service, which I'm just about done doing. I'm working with Habitat for Humanity, building houses in Skagit County, Washington. And as I said, I've appealed. So I'm hoping to get a third trial where, as I said, I could offer a necessity defense. Like my friends Emily Johnson and Annette Klapstein, other valve trainers who have been permitted a necessity defense in Minnesota.
But we have to be real here. The oil is backflowing through those pipelines. Is direct action a waste of time, or is it worth it?
I think it's the single most effective thing that we could be doing right now.
Why?
Well, it raises fundamental questions. We were able to talk, you know, bluntly, brutally about what exactly is the problem and what needs to be done. We're able to you know, call directly for a scale of change that's necessary given the scale of the threat. And it engages people, and I think in a way that ordinary policy activity doesn't. And I think one of the reasons for that is because when you're saying that the world as we know it is in danger, people expect you to act appropriately. And I think that, or we think that we are acting appropriately in the circumstances, and that gives credence to the message.
But when you turn off a pipeline, you're threatening the dollar profits of a huge investment industry and huge fossil fuel companies, and they don't like that. And there's a whole set of laws that have been passed in the United States after 9/11 about terrorism. And, of course, the corporations want to label everybody who does even the smallest action as an eco-terrorist. How do we deal with that?
Yeah, and that's, we're seeing another explosion of that in the U.S., where a number of states are considering, and some of them are passing industry-written laws to strengthen or to increase penalties for people engaging in the kinds of actions that we did on infrastructure. So we are seeing a round of that. And 84 members of Congress have written to Attorney General Jeff Sessions asking him to prosecute us under federal law. I'm actually not too worried about. Well, I think people pretty much understand the difference between terrorism, the point of which is to, you know, create terror, and what we're doing. They may not agree with what we're doing, but certainly none of the juries in any of the places where prosecutors have called us, you know, eco-terrorists, none of them seem to have bought it. I think the way that we conduct what we do, the way we speak, the fact that we simply, that we called the police, called the authorities ourselves and waited to be arrested, I think none of those actions are consistent with what you know, what terrorism is all about. And so people are able to distinguish those two things.
And it looks like governments have been monitoring social media for years, pulling out anything that smells like a threat to business. And sometimes the FBI pretends to help and sets up a sting operation. How can green activists talk to each other about this activism?
Well, I mean, in our own case, we made a kind of a decision early on that we really only wanted to have folks in our, it's not even a group, but in our effort, who just weren't too concerned, you know, who are basically willing to be transparent in what we did, not in all of the planning, but certainly in our communications. We're just not too worried about it, because a lot of what that's designed to do is to make people fearful of the possibility of charges or conspiracy charges being brought. If you're not worried about those things, then you can feel free to speak, you know, freely, transparently, and honestly, as we have done. And we think that's the best way, is simply not to worry about it.
What kind of feedback have you gotten?
Well, you know, it's ranged. Depends on, I'm looking forward to going to Missoula. I'm leaving the day after tomorrow to go speak to groups there. You know, I mean, mostly it's a factor of the society we're currently living in. Most people are speaking to other people who support what they think. So there aren't that many opportunities to go to places where there's a range of opinion, you know, outside the courtrooms. But you know, mostly what we hear is, thank heavens you're doing what you did, what you did. We need more of it.
Okay, well, we're going to wrap this up soon, Ken, but I wanted to say, look, if I hand you this microphone, what would you like to tell our listeners? Go ahead, take as long as you need. Talk to us for a minute.
You know, I feel like we're confronted, as I said, with an existential crisis here. We're not really set up to deal with longer-term threats like the one that we're facing in climate change. The world is full of immediate problems that need to be faced, and it's extremely difficult to somehow think about what we need to do to avert a catastrophe that may be years or decades down the line. But in this case, we do face a problem. We do face a threat that will make, you know, life as we know it impossible. And at least some of us need to step outside of day to day and take action on that. We don't need a lot of people. We do not. No, we need a small number of determined people to do this. So I would encourage people who are deeply concerned, like some of us are, to, you know, move from thought to action. Now is the time. We don't have many years left.
Indeed, we are running out of time. From Washington State, we've been talking with longtime eco-activist Ken Ward. Watch for that new documentary about him, and I'll put more details in my show blog at ecoshock.org. But right now, check out the Valve Turner website, Shut It Down Today. So that's shutitdown.today, and you'll get there and you'll get the latest on this. And also, you can help support the legal costs of these activists. Thank you so much, Ken, for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me. Take care.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Annette Clapstein looks like somebody's grandmother, a kind grandmother. In fact, Annette is part of the Seattle Raging Granny group. She's a mother of two and a retired attorney, and she's a valve turner. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Annette, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Good. Well, I'm glad to have you. I think you scare the oil industry. If a grandmother can be an activist, anybody can. What got you going down this path of climate activism?
Well, I have been an activist for social and environmental justice causes to some degree all of my life, since I was a teenager. I worked for the Puyallup tribe as staff attorney for 21 years, so I learned a lot from working with them, and I worked primarily on fisheries issues, so that was also, by necessity, environmental issues. And I read a lot and became aware that climate change was becoming an issue probably back in the 90s. I mean, it became an issue before that. I think I became aware of it in the early 90s. I think, like a lot of people, kind of waited for the politicians to deal with it, because surely even greedy, corrupt politicians could see that, you know, this would affect them and their children. And time went on and nobody did anything about it. Eventually, you know, I became very, very worried about what kind of future my children and all future generations are going to have, and started becoming very active around that issue. And specifically the Seattle Raging Grannies. Grannies are a group of older activist women, which there are groups across Canada and the entire United States. And we have what's called an unconvention every 2 years. And in 2012, we had an unconvention in Victoria, British Columbia, and it's a very loose-knit group with no hierarchy. People can do what they want as long as it's basically, you know, on the left, not the right. You know, we don't usually have resolutions, but at that particular unconvention, a resolution was introduced basically saying that climate change should be our top priority, that working for climate justice should be the granny's top priority, because that emergency, if it is not resolved, will foreclose action on all of the other issues that we care so much about. If we do not deal with the climate emergency, you know, we don't have a habitable planet for our grandchildren, and we have to deal with it. So the Seattle Grannies took that very seriously. We went back to Seattle and initially did a lot of lobbying. We wrote to every conceivable legislative representative at every level from city on up to national and asked for meetings. And we got meetings with some of them and asked them what they were going to do to address climate change. And it became very quickly apparent to us that, you know, we got a lot of nice talk, but no real action. So increasingly, I became aware that we were never going to get this political system to act. And I say that as somebody who worked as a lawyer for almost 30 years. We have a, you know, well, some people would say it's broken. Some people would say it does what it's designed to do, which is to protect capitalism. It does nothing else. It does not work for the people it supposedly represents. You know, we're not going to get any action through that, so it's up to us. And that is the conclusion I came to. And I first did a direct action blocking an oil train outside of Anacortes. There are two refineries up in Anacortes, Washington. Then I brought the grannies into it, and the grannies were involved in a number of actions, including helping to shut down the port of Seattle during the Shell No campaign. We locked ourselves to our rocking chairs and blockaded one of the port entrances, and a number of other groups blocked all the other entrances, so we shut down the port for a day.
Were you at the Standing Rock protest by the Sioux tribe, and how does that connect to the valve-turning action?
I was not personally there, but I know a huge number of people from Seattle who were there. I would have liked to be there, but I just did not get the opportunity to go. However, that was going on at the same time as this particular action, the valve turner action, was being planned. And there was a call out from Standing Rock for there to be 4 days of prayer and solidarity, with the resistance at Standing Rock, because that, you know, was very much the focal point of resistance to fossil fuel industry at that point.
What did you personally do to turn off a tar sands pipeline?
Well, for Emily and I, it was slightly different than for the others. All of us, you know, we had it coordinated that we were going to do it 15 minutes apart across 4 states. And we went with bolt cutters prepared to go inside and actually shut off the valves. But for us, we cut the chains that held the locks that opened the little doors into the enclosures. We went inside and, you know, we went to turn off the valves, but we had a person back in Seattle who called all of these pipeline companies 15 minutes before, you know, the scheduled shutoff. And then we had a support person on site who called 5 minutes before. And by the time we cut the bolts and got inside, almost immediately we could see that our particular pipeline was being shut off, because there was this thing that looked like a giant screw, which we could see manually going down and shutting it off. So we knew that it was being shut off remotely. So in our case, our goal of getting them to shut it down remotely actually worked.
As a former attorney, how would you describe the necessity defense?
The necessity defense is, it comes out of Old English common law, where the classic example is there is a burning building and there is a child inside, and you go to rescue the child and the door is locked. So you break the door down and rescue the child, and afterwards you're charged with burglary. And so the necessity defense is you plead, yes, technically I did do a crime. I did break the door down and break in. However, I did it to prevent the death of a child, which is a much higher good than burglary, you know, than worrying about burglary, than breaking a door. You do it to prevent a greater harm, and that's what the necessity defense is. And as I've said many times when we've gone around to speak, in our case, the world is on fire and all the children are going to burn if we don't stop it.
Are you going to be allowed to present that to a judge?
Our judge in Minnesota did grant us the right to present the necessity defense. However, the prosecutor immediately appealed that. It was heard in the Minnesota Court of Appeals on oral argument this week on February 15th. And our lawyer says he is cautiously optimistic that they may dismiss the appeal, which would mean that we would indeed get to present the necessity defense, which would give us the ability to call in climate scientists and social scientists to talk about, you know, climate scientists to talk about how dire the emergency is that we are in and how quickly we need to turn it around, and social scientists to talk about how corrupt our system is and how it does not work for the good of the people.
Now, in North America or Europe or Australia, people can decide whether to do a climate action or not. You said that choice itself is a privilege. What did you mean by that?
Well, the people who are being most affected by climate change, you know, first and worst, are the people who've done the least to cause it. And they have no choice but to fight it. They have no choice but to fight these companies that are bringing in this death dealing, you know, the pipelines that completely destroy their water, their air, their land. You look at the tar sands. That's why we pick the tar sands, because they're absolutely the worst of the worst on every level. They have absolutely devastated a huge area in Alberta, which is mostly Indigenous First Nations Cree people around there. And, you know, they have huge cancer rates. Their water is destroyed. Their land is destroyed. They've taken beautiful forests for miles and miles and miles and just absolutely remove them and turned it into a sea of toxic sludge for literally tens of miles all around. So people who are in that situation where they are literally having their lives threatened in every conceivable way have no choice but to stand up and fight it. I have a choice. I don't think I have a moral choice. You know, to be a moral human being in this time, I have to do everything I can, which is why I chose to do what I did. I will do what I have to do to stop it. And I also say that as an old white woman, I am in a better position to take the kind of risky action I took than, you know, most of my young people of color activist friends, because, frankly, the police may show up and shoot them. That happens all the time. That is unlikely to happen to me. I may go to jail, but I probably won't be killed for doing something like I did. And also, I have much less to lose. I am retired. I don't worry about having a job. My kids are grown. I don't have a family to support. And I have everything to gain for the young people in the world and those that will come after them, which is what I care about at this stage of my life.
Now, there's no legal remedy for what amounts to a developing mass murder by climate change. Do you think that someday pipeline and oil company executives might be tried for crimes against the planet, or will we have a truth and reconciliation process like South Africa did?
Well, you know, if there's any justice in the universe, they certainly would be tried for crimes against humanity. They've known since the 70s, you know, many documents have come out in just the last few years about Exxon and others. They've all known that they are causing climate change, and they've done everything in their power to obfuscate, to propagandize people to believe that it's not happening. It's now become so obvious. I think even people who said there was no climate change a few years ago are admitting, well, wow, look at Houston, look at Puerto Rico, look at the kind of hurricanes we're having. For us in the West, on the West Coast of the United States and British Columbia and Canada, what we saw this last year was a wildfire season completely unprecedented beyond anything we've ever seen. Yes, we always have wildfires, but for the first time ever, and I'm 65, I'll be 66 in June, we had weather forecasts in Seattle that were day after day smoke. That was the weather forecast, smoke. The wildfires in the mountains and all up and down the coast and inland were so bad that we had ash dropping out of the sky day after day. We had to wear masks. That's what we're facing, and it's only going to get worse. We've already got about 40 years of climate change baked into the system. There's a 40-year delay on a lot of it. It stays up there, plus what we've been adding in the meantime. So we're too late for a good outcome, but we're not too late to choose between a bad outcome and an apocalyptic outcome. And that's what we're fighting for at this point, is to save as much as we can for future generations.
When will your case be tried, Annette, and how can people support you and the other valve turners?
We don't yet know when our case will be tried. We've been told that the Court of Appeals will make their decision by May, sometime in May. And it could be sooner, but it's likely to be May. After that, assuming that they rule in our favor, well, either way, I guess, it will go back to the trial court, and they will set a date for trial. So we are assuming our trial will be sometime this summer. That's the likeliest, but we don't have a date yet. And, you know, we just had Michael Foster get sentenced to 3 years in prison in North Dakota. Two were suspended, but he is in prison right now in North Dakota. So we have a lot of legal expenses, and one of the things people can do is contribute to our legal defense fund. We really appreciate that. If you go to either our website, shutitdown.today, or our Facebook page, which is called Climate Direct Action, it's shutitdown-climatedirectaction. Either one will direct you to our legal defense fund, and we really need people to contribute. Beyond that, we would love to have people come out to our trial. I think, you know, any of us who get jail time would probably welcome visitors if people happen to be in those areas. We don't want people to commute long distances to visit us, but people who might be in the States, we'd be serving time and we'd love to have visitors. And we hope that people will go out and get active. That is the most important thing. This is a, you know, the emergency of not only our lifetime, but really of humanity's lifetime. If we don't turn this around, we are in a world of hurt, and people need to look beyond their comfort and convenience and do everything in their power to put a stop to what the fossil fuel industry is doing to our planet. They really are. They're the real criminals. We don't see ourselves as criminals, but we certainly see them as criminals.
From Washington State, we've been talking with valve turner Annette Klapstein. As she says, find out more at the website shutitdown.today. Thank you so much for talking with us, Annette.
Thank you.
The Valve Turners.
We just have a little time to hear why climate activists must not be silenced about the dire necessity of taking action now. This is a recording of the oral argument for the defense in the Minnesota State Appeals Court in February 2018 by lawyer Tim Phillips.
There are four elements on this that are spelled out in State versus Ryan, and I'll go through them briefly. First, whether the harm that would have resulted from obeying the law would have significantly exceeded the harm actually caused by breaking the law. Here, the greater harm that respondents were targeting was not merely government policy that they disagreed with, but an ongoing catastrophic series of harms from climate change. The action was not merely symbolic. In coordination with other people, all tar sands oil entering the United States was shut off at the same time. Any harm from respondents' action, which simply involved breaking chains securing the site with a bolt cutter, any harm from that was superficial in comparison to the harms of climate change that respondents sought to prevent. The second element is whether there was a legal alternative to breaking the law. The scientific consensus is we are living in a climate emergency. If lobbying or lawsuits or other legal alternatives were capable of adequately addressing this emergency, they would have resulted in some meaningful legislative change, climate policy, and so on before this emergency spun out of control as it has. Respondents do not need to rebut every conceivable alternative. The third element under Ryan is whether respondents were in danger of imminent physical harm. Climate change is currently occurring, harming people in every part of the world. It's harming people through superstorms, floods, heat waves, droughts, wildfires. The list goes on and on. And in Massachusetts versus EPA, the United States Supreme Court found that the EPA's refusal to regulate greenhouse gas emissions was an, quote, imminent harm to Massachusetts in light of the wealth of negative effects, including sea level rise and so on, that result from climate change. Respondents, like the rest of us, are in danger of imminent climate change harms. And the last element is whether there was a direct causal connection between breaking the law and preventing the harm. Respondents' actions, again, collectively with others, shut down tar sands pipelines, which are, according to the EPA, significantly more greenhouse gas intensive than other crudes, have potentially large climate impacts with emissions that could be 81% greater than emissions from the average crude refined in the United States. There couldn't be a stronger necessity case involving political issues than this one.
That was lawyer Tim Phillips arguing to the Minnesota Appeals Court on behalf of the Valve Turners, Annette Klapstein and Emily Johnston. Find out more about these brave climate activists in my show blog at ecoshock.org and at their website, shutitdown.today. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Now, on this issue, our timing couldn't be more appropriate, in my opinion, because this has been a kind of a wake-up call for the Canadian labor movement. It's not known for its excitement generally, but it has now developed into is going through a phase where it has to examine its conscience of what kind of movement it wishes to be. We're joined now, I believe, by Rick Hockley. Are you there, Rick?
Yes. Hello, Phil. Good evening.
Good evening. And Rick, you, of course, are an activist and member of Local 75 of Unite Here. Just to begin with, ask the obvious, your union, Unite Here, has been in the news, and the name linked to it is Unifor, because Unifor did something very dramatic. They withdrew from the Canadian Labour Congress sort of on short notice, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And then after that, they announced that they are going to take in members of Unite Here. And the Unite Here, as I understand it, serves the hotel workers of Toronto.
Yeah, hospitality Toronto workers. Yeah.
Give us a background idea. Tell us about your union, first of all. I mean, Unite Here has how many members, and who does it represent?
Yeah, absolutely. So Unite Here, it's a hospitality workers union. So you'd referenced hotels, but we also represent food service workers and casino and gaming workers across North America. Mm-hmm. So I believe it's around 265,000 members strong that we have, the largest hospitality workers union in the world. Within our local of Toronto, we're about 7,500 members currently.
Mm-hmm. And this period, were you, surprised, or how did this come about that you find that you woke up one day? You must have been surprised at some stage that a union such as Unifor was going to was announcing that they were going to attempt to win your members. By the way, the old-fashioned word for this is raid.
Raid, yes, yes. Well, it was the exact same day that they left the CLC. So, obviously it was premeditated from quite a while. I'm assuming at least the last couple of months that this is, been their plan, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
From our end, again, I was the former executive board member of our Local 75. I'd sat there for the past 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
I've been through the day-to-day business and know how the union functions. And, this is something that definitely was a curveball for us. Wasn't expected at all. Again, not in the spirit mm-hmm. of solidarity to kind of come in and raid another union, right?
So yes.
We're supposed to be,
Well, you belong to the Canadian Labour Congress, which has a constitution. It has bylaws. And it has methods of resolving disputes.
Absolutely. The dispute to resolve in regards to changing unions is actually called Article 4 mm-hmm. of the CLC Constitution. Mm-hmm. But this is something that was never invoked by either party, either of Unite Here or of Unifor. When all this change came about, this is the first time that us within Unite Here was hearing of it as well. We were, hearing everything, through the media, essentially. Mm-hmm. So it was definitely a shock for us. Again, just in regards to, the fundamental principles of a union is, to fight injustice and discrimination and harassment in the workplace. And then you have, a union mm-hmm. that should be kind of working together with yourself to raise up Canadian workers and their mm-hmm. families, and then they're kind of coming in to divide and mislead people.
Yeah. Let me ask, what was the reaction of the Canadian Labour Congress? I'll just tell you, frankly, myself, I was impressed. I mean, mm-hmm. I didn't think they would get their act together so quickly and make such helpful statements. Give me your assessment of the Canadian Labour Congress.
You know what? we are so thankful and grateful for, you know, all our sisters and brothers within the CLC and the Canadian labor movement. We've had such an outpouring of support from everyone, from all, you know, unions from all over. It doesn't matter what kind of industry and whatnot. And I'm not a part of the CLC. I can't really speak for them directly, but I did have the privilege of going there just 2 weeks ago. I went to Ottawa for a meeting with all the leaders of the CLC. Mm-hmm. They had invited myself and two other colleagues of mine from Unite Here to speak to them and kind of basically go through, you know, what we're facing today in this battle of being raided. Mm-hmm. I sat right next to the president of the ATU, who is the, you know, the ATU is the union that represents the Toronto transit workers, Local 113. And
oh, that's a, funny you should mention,
through,
yes.
Yeah, they had gone through the exact same thing 1 year prior to us, you know, under this false flag narrative of an American invasion and you know, whatever else they want to spin it. So it was interesting perspective to kind of hear from all these other people and industries that I wasn't aware of, that they had a similar story to us in regards to being raided, especially in regards to Unifor. Kind of seems to be practice of them to kind of come and pick up the pieces, so to speak, of mm-hmm. of various you know, locals and unions all over. So
We're speaking to Rick Hockley. He's an activist in Local 75 Unite Here. And we ought to say, of course, too, you were put to the test, and as I understand it, 24 hotels were in a bargaining situation, and so they took a vote over who to represent them.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, I was impressed, given the suddenness of the attack by a big union with deep pockets.
Deep pockets, for sure.
A lot of us thought, well, this, you know, this is going to be ugly. So, but actually, it's an impressive outcome. Talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, we weren't expecting that to happen, of you know, all of our majority of our union staff to kind of leave the office and go to an opposing union, you know, and being able to have that access to our members in regards to having the personal contact in the workplace and at home. But of those 24 hotels that were attempted to be raided by Unifor, 17 of us, the hotels, stuck together with Unite Here from the beginning. There were some votes in the remaining, five of which decided to leave us, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And then two hotels are still remaining. There's boxes that are sealed by the labor board currently.
Mm-hmm.
So we're expecting the results in about 2 to 3 weeks of those two hotels. And, going forward, you know, we're a union. We respect all the democratic voices of our members. And mm-hmm. hopefully in time, this is something that, you know, people will come to look back and see that it has only made us stronger as Unite Here, you know, mm-hmm. to kind of go through this kind of internal battle and kind of rev up our members in regards to, putting really what's at stake for ourselves and for our families in regards to, you know, our benefits and job security and our wages. You know, a lot of workers, they spoke loud and clear that they didn't want to risk or jeopardize that and that they stuck with Unite Here, the Hospitality Workers Union.
Mm-hmm. This is Rick Hockley, and he's active in Unite Here, and is also you're a banquet server in the Novotels, right?
Yes, yeah. So, I've, again, serving bartend for like the last 15 years. So just a normal rank and file Canadian worker. And again, I've been a part of, involved within the union by becoming a shop steward and chief shop steward of my property. And then, again, I was elected 2008 for the first term to become an executive board member to help run, the business of our union and make bigger decisions, extraordinary expenditures and stuff. So,
Well, let me ask you, because it's striking to me that my understanding is that the president who went over to Unifor, this is an issue, allegedly, of as told, if the other narrative, the uniform narrative is, well, these are Americans who trample on the rights of the workers, et cetera, of Canada. But didn't this individual come from the United States? And she's not herself a rank-and-file person.
Well, yes, she's not Canadian either. She's American for sure. You know, yeah.
That's a curious story they put together.
Well, again, this false narrative of you know, patriotism and nationalism, it sells well in the media, but at the end of the day, this is something that was never discussed within our union, and no one ever had the problem of, you know, having a president from the States. Again, we're an international union, right? Mm-hmm. You know, these companies that we're up against, that we're fighting, you know, these global hotel corporations or, you know, billion-dollar conglomerates, you know, they don't have borders. They don't look at where you're from or, mm-hmm. you know, this sort of thing. So this is something that was never ever discussed with us, and it was never a problem, something that we never thought about. And again, in learning what happened previously with the ATU in Toronto last year, that was the same narrative. That they, the exact same. And again, that was something that, the president was Bob Kinnear, and he lost. You know, I believe he lost the election in his vote to remain president, kind of threw a fit, and that was kind of what he ended up doing, was trying to go over to Unifor and just kind of steal his members. So, definitely not something that we look at. We don't, Unite here within Toronto, you know, one of the most diverse cities of the world. We have workers probably from, I believe, 80 or 90 countries. We come from all over the globe. We're mm-hmm. majority workers of color, people like immigrants, people of color, and you know, where you're from, it doesn't mean anything. It just adds to the strength and diversity of our union, and adds that kind of unique voice that we have.
Unite Here actually has a very progressive, the word progressive is raised once in a while to as a banner, and Unite Here has a progressive history and reputation that must have served you well during this fight.
Yeah, I mean, again, we're a grassroots organization, right? Like, we're led by the workers. We, like myself as a worker, we are the leaders of the organization. You know, this doesn't come from the top down. We're not a corporation. You know, we have the ability to have a voice, to have a vote, and that's something that is, you know, maybe a little bit unique to us, sadly, when really it should be kind of like that all across unions and all across, you know, the world, you know, workers' power, right? So we're all stronger together, and we're all kind of at the end of the same thing.
And let's talk about the issue that allegedly triggered all of this was the matter of trusteeship. And, of course, everyone hears the word trusteeship, and that's an automatic worrying phenomena, but that every union has that capacity. It's an instrument that belongs to unions to salvage crisis situations. Am I right? I mean, and tell me, how did trusteeship come about, and why did that cause your previous leaders to decide they're going to jump overboard?
Mm-hmm. Again, it is in all unions, bylaws and constitutions, this provision of trusteeship to kind of have a last case, you know, scenario should we need to invoke such a thing. You know, for our union, our local within Toronto, you know, this is something, again, that wasn't a brash, swift decision by our international. This is a long time coming. The executive board, we asked back in December of 2016 to invoke the trusteeship, because at that point, you know, our former president was just constantly making decisions unilaterally, not respecting the democratic voice of the governing body, which is the elected executive board members. Again, all rank and file members from within our hotels and food service that sit to govern our union. Mm-hmm. So that was something, again, from December of 2016 that we had reached out to our international, because by that point, nothing was getting done. The day-to-day functioning and operation of our union was being hindered. and it was all for
So the request was made by whom?
Our executive board. So our executive board consists of 25 working members, elected officers, that we have 25 plus, we have two trustees and three officers. So of the 30 of us, the majority is about 75% of us had asked for this trusteeship to kind of come in. And again, that was in December of 2016. We also had asked back, I believe, in April of 2017, and it wasn't invoked until this January of 2018. So again, our international.
So it wasn't precipitous, and it wasn't decided at the at the big headquarters.
No, no, not at all. Again, this is something that ourselves as the executive board had been asking and begging for a long time, because we saw really the again the day-to-day functioning of our local was just being spent on someone's personal motives and someone's personal gains versus the day-to-day business of bettering our members.
And that's why is that instrument has to be occasionally employed.
Yeah.
I want to ask you this. We've also heard reports that some of the differences that got sharp and unpleasant in the fighting that caused the trusteeship to be brought into place involved issues of sexual harassment and racism. Is that true? Is there any content to that?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, this all of this kind of conflict, it stems, you know, back in the fall of 2016, progressively getting worse and worse. And then it came to this point where we were finally able to impose the trusteeship. It really shouldn't have come to that point, but it was clear that we had no other choice. And the international union
had
no choice.
Members who complained that they were being racialized in their dealings with staff and or executive. Right?
Yeah, so it was, you know, there was a lot of racism structurally within our local office in regards to demotions, promotions, hiring people, suspensions and that sort of thing. When a complaint or allegation was brought up, it wasn't investigated properly, depending on who was saying it. So there was even, there was a lot of tolerance, but even kind of encouragement, if you look at it. And then obviously there was a lot of individual stories of racism where, our leaders, our organizers who have really built our union, a lot of rank and file organizers who've come up to, be a part of the labor movement and better workers' life the last, couple of decades that have been there for a long time, they were being treated like criminals, and a lot of people went on sick leaves with stress and just really upsetting things that it was just shocking because, again, for
when I hear this, I have to say it sounds to me like rather than leaving your union, they're fugitives from justice. I mean, you have to actually complete that investigation and there has to be determination if people were discriminated against, who did it, and some guarantee that they'll be protected in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, a lot of the complaints towards the people who had now left our organization, right? But they're still obviously our international is investigating those claims. And again, it's a process. It'll be a couple of months, I'm sure, further. But
the word trusteeship. And you tell me this story, I mean, that you had members who said that they were being treated in a racist way by people who should have been serving their best interest of the union. I'd like to say to see clauses that those things will be immediately investigated, maybe not a trusteeship, but every union should arrive and say, hold it, somebody has said these things or there is an allegation. We want to get to the bottom of it, and we're not going to wait 3 months.
Again, I think there was just so much happening within our union. Again, it's mainly, the division line racially was all, the white people on one side, and then you have the people of color, mainly black and brown organizers on the other. And that really translated to, the officers of our local down to the organizers, which then really went to the executive board and then through the hotels. Myself, I'm a white Caucasian male, but I sided on the side of justice, and it was on the side of the people of color, just how it happened to be. But it's definitely something that we were pushing for a long time to, you know, deal with things in a swift manner and not let it get to such a point that it got to. But again, legally and all that kind of,
you have to dot the I's and cross the T's.
It's all kind of being done, you know, with lawyers and looking into, you know, different investigations, all that stuff. So that's kind of out of my hands, but definitely something that will be changing.
My impression is you could be very proud of Unite here and the way it's handled all of this. And Rick Hockley, it's great that we could talk to you. I congratulate Unite here 75, and frankly, the Canadian Labor Congress comes through looking very good. I hope we can talk to you again, say, in a month or two, and kind of assess how this progresses.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, we're very excited for the future, and we're just very thankful to have the opportunity to have our voice heard from you, Bill, and we'll definitely be around.
A lot of people in the labor movement have been waiting to hear Local 75 people talk, and you have done it. And Rick Hockley, thank you again very, very much. We look forward to talking to you.
My pleasure, Phil. Thank you so much for your time again.
Sure thing. Okay. Bye-bye. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And again, facebook.com/The Taylor Report and SoundCloud, Taylor-Report. We're going to take a musical break. We'll be back, and we're going to be talking to the author, Terry Watata, who happens to be a CIUT veteran.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Andrew Patrick of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, who assesses the response to the Florida school massacre and the prospect that student activism could help weaken the NRA's power to block new gun control measures. Mary Sweeters with Greenpeace USA, who talks about what environmental groups and their allies are doing to fight the Trump administration's plan to open up 90% of America's coastlines to oil and gas drilling. And Nathan Schneider, assistant professor in media studies at the University of Colorado, who discusses his recent article titled, A Populism of Hope Begins When People Feel Their Own Power. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The British aid group Oxfam is in crisis over claims that its former director in Haiti hosted sex parties with prostitutes in the aftermath of that nation's massive 2010 earthquake. Public disclosure of the scandal in the Times of London led to the resignation of Oxfam's deputy chief executive, Penny Lawrence, and the group has lost high-profile supporters, including South African anti-apartheid leader Desmond Tutu. A former Oxfam internal investigator, Helen Evans, complained of a culture of sexual abuse, maintaining that within the agency, top Oxfam officials didn't take allegations of abuse seriously. A 2011 Oxfam investigation led to the resignation of the group's Haiti director, Ronald Van Houwer-Mayrin, and termination of other aid workers. Van Houwer-Mayrin was recently linked to other sex abuse allegations in both Chad and Liberia. Oxfam's international director, Winnie Byanyima, promised an independent inquiry into the failure of the group's investigation into allegations of sexual abuse in 2011. She also pledged that Oxfam will triple its budget for internal investigations and upgrade protections for whistleblowers. In early January, Attorney General Jeff Sessions reversed a 2013 Obama administration memo directing the U.S. Justice Department to respect the recent liberalization of state marijuana laws. Now Sessions, the Justice Department, and the Drug Enforcement Agency are in court defending its crackdown on cannabis against a wide-ranging lawsuit filed by plaintiffs ranging from a U.S. military veteran to a former pro football player. The Christian Science Monitor reports that some U.S. attorneys may go the extreme route to target growers, dispensers, and users in states that have legalized cannabis. But other U.S. attorneys have signaled they are reluctant to interfere with state marijuana laws. The Massachusetts U.S. attorney, for example, has refused to declare his intent, which could complicate a summer deadline for the state to legalize recreational marijuana sales passed by voter referendum. Today, legal marijuana is a multi-billion-dollar industry from Portland, Oregon to Portland, Maine. In recent years, 29 states have legalized the medical use of marijuana, while 8 have legalized the drug's recreational use. A Gallup poll in January found that for the first time, just over half of all Republicans, 51%, support legalization of recreational marijuana. Overall, 94% of Americans support medical marijuana, according to a 2017 Quinnipiac poll. Midwest progressives have launched a major campaign to defeat Democratic Congressman Dan Lipinski, who represents Chicago's blue-collar Southwest side. For a generation, the socially conservative Lipinski family has held Illinois' 3rd congressional district seat. A leader of the Blue Dog Coalition of conservative Democrats, Lipinski opposes women's reproductive rights, Obamacare, and a path to citizenship for DACA recipients. Progressives are backing businesswoman Marie Newman, who supports Medicare for All, a $15 an hour minimum wage, and worker rights. In addition to picking up the endorsements of Democracy for America and MoveOn.org, Newman won the backing of New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who hosted a Chicago campaign fundraiser for the candidate. Lipinski's supporters include billionaire Jerry Reinsdorf, a major donor of Illinois' right-wing Republican Governor Bruce Rauner. During last year's presidential primary, Bernie Sanders won the district by 8 points, signaling a leftward shift. A month before the March 20th primary, the Newman campaign's internal polls find that the first-time candidate is now leading Lipinski by 5 points. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In one of the deadliest mass shooting incidents in the U.S., 17 people were killed and 15 were wounded at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, on February 14th. Police say 19-year-old Nicholas Cruz entered the school armed with a semi-automatic AR-15 rifle, a gas mask, smoke grenades, and multiple magazines of ammunition, and shot students and teachers after pulling a fire alarm in the building. The group Every Town for Gun Safety reports that since 2013, there have been nearly 300 school shootings in America, an average of about one a week. The massacre in South Florida has reignited the long-running national debate on the need to establish stricter controls on the sale of firearms and who can purchase them. During the years of Republican control of Congress, legislators have refused to strengthen background checks for gun buyers or reimpose a ban on military-style assault weapons. In fact, following the National Rifle Association's agenda, Congress passed and Donald Trump signed a law reversing an Obama administration initiative that made it harder for people with mental illness to buy a gun. But a surprising new force has arisen from the Florida school shooting tragedy. Students at the Parkland School, through their grief and pain, have staged powerful protests against Congress and their own state legislature for their failure to address gun violence. Students and their allies are now organizing nationwide school walkouts on March 14th and April 20th, and a March 24th protest rally is planned in Washington, D.C., and other cities across the U.S. Your reporter spoke with Andrew Patrick, media director with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Here he assesses the response to the Florida school shooting and the prospect that new student activism could help break the deadlock in Congress.
In June 2016, we saw Orlando, which surpassed Virginia Tech as the most horrific mass shooting. Then just last October, we saw the Las Vegas and then the deadliest church shooting in Sutherland Springs. And now we have the deadliest high school shooting. And it is horrific and awful and horrible to see every single time. The scenes are all too familiar of children running out of a school like it's a war zone. The breaking news alerts, terrified parents. It's kind of become a unfortunate, awful part of American life. The difference is this time we have seen this rapid movement take place grassroots by these students who have been incredibly passionate, but also very smart and very savvy and very poised in their response to this. And that not only has kept us talking about the issue of gun violence, but also it feels like there is a real movement afoot to actually make some changes.
Andrew, what's the difference? What provoked, you think, these students, unlike others in previous horrendous mass murder incidents? Why do you think they've taken a different route to dealing with their mourning of their fellow students, but also anger, which has fueled their action and calls for mass demonstrations across the country?
Yeah, it's really remarkable. These students, if you were a sophomore or a freshman in this high school, you would have been in elementary school when Sandy Hook happened 5 years ago. So this is an issue that they've grown up with, this horror of this unique horror of American life that they've seen. And I think there is just to be able to have a student-led, grassroots-led group come out. I mean, I'm sure they're talking to some of the other groups, but I mean, this is really being led, and it's their voices, it's their words, it's their passion, and it's remarkable to see. And everyone, I mean, from the president, according to reports, to parents across the country, to gun owners, to NRA members, are really hearing them. And it's something that we really haven't quite seen before. Everyone thought Sandy Hook was going to be the turning point, and it was in many ways. It built the current movement we're seeing now, but Sandy Hook turned out to be the catalyst, and now we're actually starting to get to a place where people are really becoming single-issue voters and activists on this year-round, not just following a horrific tragedy.
After so many mass shooting incidents, there are many people in the country who are cynical that any action will be forthcoming from Congress, because the recent history shows that Congress, dominated by Republicans, many of whom get a lot of their campaign contributions from the National Rifle Association, has effectively blocked any action on the part of Congress, including stopping people on the terrorist watch list from purchasing guns. Just an amazing number of proposals have been blocked. Is there any reason to hope that things will be different this time?
Well, I think, and you saw this movement kind of start to take place after the Las Vegas shooting. It's not just that these bills are being introduced, it's that they're bipartisan bills. The Fix NICS Act that came up after the Sutherland Springs shooting that would improve our federal background check system, because our background checks, it's good to have them, but they only work as well as the information we put in there. It turned out in that case that the proper information was not carried over to stop that person from getting a gun. It is a bill from Senator Cornyn of Texas, Senator Hatch of Utah, and the two senators from Connecticut. It is a bipartisan bill, and we're looking at real solutions in Congress, but also at the state level, which is where most of this action is going to take place. Congress has a difficult time passing a budget. They have a difficult time keeping the government open. They have a difficult time passing farm bills. Tackling gun violence is an incredibly hard and complicated issue that requires broad support from both sides. And with all these mass shootings, we're slowly starting to take these modest steps to get there. So we're hopeful that some of these laws, maybe an ending the ban on the CDC ban on research, is another thing that we, I think, could attract bipartisan support. And these bills in and of themselves are not going to stop all gun violence. No one's saying that. What we're saying is these are steps moving in the right direction. And then hopefully down the line, we can really start to see some of these more comprehensive universal background checks, assault weapons bans. At least the discussion is taking place. So in a Republican president, Republican House, Republican Senate, these are good signs, because we thought we were going to be playing defense on bad NRA bills this entire session of Congress. And it turns out we're actually starting to push some of the items that we'd like to see.
That was Andrew Patrick, media director with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Learn more about the student actions and the campaign to enact common sense gun regulations by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On January 8th, the Trump administration released its five-year draft plan to open up 90% of all coastlines around the U.S. to oil and gas drilling, with just a small part of Alaska and Hawaii's coastlines not included in the plan. Soon after the directive was released, Rick Scott, the Republican governor of Florida, requested an exemption, citing the uniqueness of the state's coastline that would be at risk if an oil spill accident occurred. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke famously granted the exemption request via a tweet. The requested exemption, however, is not a done deal, as the acting director of the Federal Bureau of Ocean Energy Management has not signed off on it. Meanwhile, many other governors of coastline states have also asked for exemptions. The Trump administration's move to open up most of America's coastal areas to oil and gas drilling was met with immediate and widespread opposition. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mary Sweeters, a climate and energy campaigner with Greenpeace USA, who talks about what environmental groups and their allies are doing to fight the oil drilling plan and the next steps in the campaign.
When this proposed plan came out in January, that initiated a 60-day comment period, in which time the public has the opportunity to comment on this proposed plan, as well as legislators, interest organizations, the industry. Anybody can kind of weigh in on it. And we've actually seen a lot of opposition already. There have been rallies and kind of big turnout. Some of the hearings that were scheduled in each state. Back here in California, we had, you know, over 500 people show up to Sacramento last week. Some people came in on buses from all over the state. Similar rallies have been happening along coastal states everywhere. We've also seen bipartisan opposition to the proposed plan. Governors and legislators on both sides of the aisle have stated their opposition to this. Thousands of businesses have come out against offshore drilling on both the Atlantic and the Pacific coast. So there's definitely been a real sense of opposition to this that's been organized and vocal from the start.
And approval of drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge took place a few weeks before this draft plan was put out as part of the tax cut package, after decades of successful efforts to prevent the drilling there. What's happening with that?
As it is with offshore drilling, there are folks in Alaska and across the country who are getting ready to, you know, have protested this, want to protect this place. It is a sacred place for the Gwich'in people who rely on the health of the porcupine caribou herd for their culture and livelihood. It's a place for, you know, a lot of people visit for recreation. It's an incredible, unique ecosystem. And a lot of people have fought for decades to protect this place and will continue to do so. So right now, it just sort of remains to be seen what's the next step in terms of when there will be proposals for exploration. And those will also include, I believe, comment periods and opportunities for an environmental review that's necessary for exploration to begin.
Mary Sweeters, what is Greenpeace doing to oppose this? And are you working in coalition with other groups?
We've been doing a few things. We have been helping to mobilize our supporters and our members to these public hearings in multiple states. We've also been working to make it as easy as we can to let folks know, here's what's on the table, here's how you can, you know, make sure to submit your public comment. We've connected folks to the representatives to make sure that they can contact their representatives to vote no on some bad proposed bills around offshore drilling. We've also joined with a number of other organizations on a lawsuit to uphold permanent protections in the Arctic and Atlantic Ocean, because those are also being jeopardized by the executive order that the Trump administration released last year, and as part of that proposed five-year plan would jeopardize those protections.
Well, what about the Pacific Ocean?
The lawsuit that we joined with a number of other organizations, that's specifically to uphold the permanent protections that were put in place by the Obama administration for about 98% of the federal waters in the Arctic Ocean, and for an important area along the Atlantic that would protect underwater seamounts and kind of a unique ecosystem in that area. And those areas were permanently withdrawn from any sort of consideration for leasing, and so we want to ensure that those specific protections were in place. In addition to that, we're also certainly mobilizing folks and making sure people know how to contact the administration to protect all of our waters from this five-year drilling proposal.
A subset of opponents is focused on the impacts on sea life from the drilling and everything that goes along with that. That's a big issue, right?
Actually, a precursor to offshore drilling is what's called seismic blasting or seismic air gun blasting. And this is the process to find where there are oil and gas deposits under the seabed floor. And this is a very loud process and involves shooting compressed air toward the seafloor every 10 to 20 seconds for sometimes days or weeks at a time over a huge swath of ocean. And this has been shown to cause harm and even death to marine mammals, as well as plankton all the way down at the base of the food chain. So it's very much a concern for the health of fisheries and for the general ecosystem. But then, aside from seismic blasting, when oil drilling starts, you certainly have the risk of oil spills, which would affect wildlife such as the endangered northern Atlantic right whale in the Atlantic Ocean, the Arctic marine ecosystem, which, as we know, is very unique and also very fragile. There's polar bears, beluga, an assortment of marine mammals that are found nowhere else that would be at great risk from an oil spill. Same in the Gulf of Mexico and the Pacific. They all have their own unique ecosystems, and those wildlife would be at inevitable risk from an oil spill. But on top of that, this is locking us into decades of climate change emissions. So this is something that we already know these ecosystems are in peril from climate change. We're seeing the Arctic melting at a rate about twice the rate of the rest of the globe. And we know that this climate change is affecting our ocean ecosystems significantly. And so offshore oil drilling will just lock us into more of those climate emissions that we just can't afford.
That was Mary Sweeters, a climate and energy campaigner with Greenpeace USA. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is holding one hearing in each state on the Trump administration's oil drilling proposal. And the public has until March 9th to send in their comments. For additional information on the campaign opposing expanded oil drilling in America's coasts, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Contemporary peace and social movements in the U.S., from the millions who rallied to fight for civil rights and racial justice, and those that mobilized to oppose the Vietnam War and subsequent American interventions abroad, often look to history for guidance on how to effect change. In a recent article, Nathan Schneider, assistant professor in media studies at the University of Colorado and author, examined some of the lessons today's progressive activists can learn from the populist movements of the late 19th century. In his article titled, A Populism of Hope Begins When People Feel Their Own Power, Schneider recounts how white and black farmers from the American South and West revolted against the financial power of urban robber barons that included financier J.P. Morgan, steel magnate Andrew Carnegie, and Standard Oil's John D. Rockefeller. Schneider notes that it was not grievances against an unfair economic system alone that stimulated the farmers' movement to grow and go on to win victories. Rather, he points out that the farmers' creation of cooperatives served as an engine of counter-economy, which became a source of inspiration and a means of material support. Farmers of the populist era, who eventually made common cause with the largest labor union of that time, used their cooperatives, known as the Farmers' Alliance, to bypass the economic monopolies of the robber barons, using their collective power to purchase supplies, sell their products, and extend credit to their own members. Your reporter spoke with Nathan Schneider, who explains why he believes that popular social movements through history have needed to create their own alternative systems and models of empowerment in order to inspire success.
Turning back to that moment really started for me the morning after the election of Donald Trump as president. I'd had for some weeks a book on my bedstand called The Populist Moment by Goodwin, and just that title kind of grabbed me after that election and made me curious to go back to other populist moments where people in one form or another turned against an elite. And what I found in that story was a very different kind of populist moment, a very, very different one, one that arose out of a lot of the same concerns. In the late 19th century, it was not financialization of everything in Silicon Valley and automation and globalization. It was railroads and oil and urban bankers. And the ways that people resisted first began with developing their own economic alternatives, developing cooperatives, developing their own tools and organizations, unions in the city, especially through the Knights of Labor in the countryside. It was through the Grange or the Farmers Alliance. And what resulted in the form of the Populist Party in the late 1880s and early 1890s was a populism that was fueled by people's sense of their own power, their own capacity to change the world around them through those economic alternatives. And it resulted in a really different set of policies, a more hopeful set of ambition. And, you know, one example of that is in 1893, the year after the populists elected their own governor to the state of Colorado here, Colorado became one of the first states to pass women's suffrage. That's one of many ways in which this movement envisioned a much more hopeful future than I think the populism of today does.
Nathan, turning to the contemporary scene where so many people have reached their limits and are quite upset and angry about their economic futures and their children's economic futures in this current system. What is going on today that you feel parallels some of the creative institution building that was going on in the populist era? Are there contemporary examples of new movements that have developed? I would just point to two that I'm familiar with, and our listeners maybe because they've been guests on this program over the years, and that is Gar Alperovitz, a professor, has joined with other people in terms of forming something they call the Democracy Collaborative. And Richard Wolff, who has a radio show and is widely known for his groundbreaking work on progressive economic alternatives, he's got an organization called Democracy at Work. Those are just two examples, and I'm sure you have many more that you can share with us.
Absolutely. There's a new generation of people who are pouring into this cooperative movement, turning to it almost as if they're starting by scratch often. And this is really the subject of my next book, which is coming out later this year, called Everything for Everyone. And it's a kind of chronicle of the movement that I've been exploring since seeing it emerge out of Occupy Wall Street and the movement, the protest movements of that period. Where groups from Occupy Wall Street, from the movements around Europe that came around the same time, out of Black Lives Matter, you had people, young people, turning to this cooperative model again, and they're finding success all over the country. Cities all over the country are starting to implement the necessary enabling policies to help support worker ownership. At a moment where workers are being kind of pressed from all sides. And we see a lot of new formations starting to emerge. I've been working very much in the realm of what we call platform cooperatives, which is cooperative models in the online economy. And so, you know, every day I'm talking with entrepreneurs around the world who are trying to build successful online businesses that really put people first before investor profits. And it's really exciting to see that. One organization I would add to your list there is the New Economy Coalition, which has become in the United States a really vital container for this kind of work. And one thing that they do really well, I think, is put a range of issues at the center, especially racial justice, gender justice, a range of concerns in addition to economic democracy that help these kinds of models really address the vital concerns that people are facing right now.
That was Nathan Snyder, professor of media studies at the University of Colorado Boulder and author of Thank You, Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse, and God in Proof. Find a link to Snyder's articles and essays by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBSU in Brockport, New York, GDPR in Nashville, Tennessee, WTND in Macon, Illinois, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Mad Nation. Another school shooting. 17 souls gone. Teachers and students and staff. America, which bills itself as the greatest of nations, is as helpless as a kitten. It has no solution. Today in school, students have about as much protection as did we, who, as students, were told in the 50s and 60s to duck and cover under our desks in the event of a nuclear bombing. Today, they're told to lock themselves in a classroom or a closet. No protection. None at all. When over 20 babies were killed in New England several years ago, I said nothing would change. Today, years later, America, a mad nation. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. supremacy means white male supremacy. When Donald Trump lamented at the loss of one of his employees' career, a bomb of female protest erupted, for he, not surprisingly, ignored the suffering of his employees' ex-wives. The only real surprise here was why the surprise? After the Roy Moore debacle of a U.S. Senate candidate's Lolita complex, as in a hankering for young girls, who can dare plead surprise? Only someone who hasn't really been looking can feign surprise. Trump's central program is to somehow return America to the 1950s when Negroes were quiet, women were submissive, and Hispanics knew their place, like Mexico, Puerto Rico. This fever dream, a Back to the Future reality show, is the focus of Trump World. To do this, you have to ignore history to build a new history in imitation of the supposed old days. Yes, it's crazy, but it ain't the only time the U.S. went crazy. Consider the war mania that resulted from 9/11. War on anybody to quell the beating heart drunk with fear. Iraq, check. Afghanistan, double check. War to salve the worried American soul. In Trump world, blacks don't count. Hispanics don't count. Arabs don't count. Women don't count either. Yes, even white women. It's time for the good old boys. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
What ways does the current system of policing and law enforcement reflect America's legacy of slavery? Why would the collapse of modern capitalism be an indispensable prerequisite in the eradication of racism? How does media and popular culture perpetuate the bondage of blacks within America? What is Canada's record on racial intolerance toward black people, and how does that legacy express itself within Canadian society today? Is there renewed hope for Mumia Abu-Jamal, one of the most famous victims of racism within America's justice system? On this week's Global Research News Hour radio program, on the occasion of Black History Month, we examine some of the legacy of white supremacy as it has flourished within the North American context. Our guests include editor of Pan-African Newswire, Abayomi Azikiwe, professor, author, poet, and historian, Afua Cooper, and international concerned family and friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal campaigner, Suzanne Ross. On this week's program, Black History Month Special, The Myths and Realities of Liberation Within the United States and Canada. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of February 23rd, 2018. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and Campus Community Radio Station, CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. On the heels of Iowa and Ohio, Wyoming has become the third state to introduce a bill criminalizing the type of activities undertaken by past oil and gas pipeline protesters. One of the Wyoming bill's co-sponsors even says it was inspired by the protests led by the Standing Rock Sioux tribe against the Dakota Access Pipeline, and a sheriff involved in policing those protests testified in support of the bill at a recent hearing. Wyoming's bill is essentially a copy-paste version of template legislation produced by the conservative corporate-funded American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. At the organization's December meeting, ALEC members voted on the model bill, the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act, which afterward was introduced in both Iowa and Ohio. Like the ALEC version, Wyoming's Senate File 74 makes, quote, impeding critical infrastructure a felony, punishable by imprisonment for not more than 10 years, a fine of not more than $100,000, or both, unquote. That comes from the article, Cracking Down on Pipeline Protests, Wyoming Now Third State to Propose ALEC Bill, by Steve Horn, posted February 22nd, originally appearing at DSmog blog. If they're not Fox News fans, MSNBC, CNN, and the rest of the liberal extremist media have probably already convinced them that the Russian government is responsible, as has resistance royalty, Bernie Sanders, Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Tribe, and California Congressional Reps Adam Schiff, Ted Lieu, and Jackie Speier, just to name a few. I mentioned the Californian reps because I live here, where they make the most noise when they're not in Washington, although many Americans outside the Golden State now recognize the glazed eyes and fundamentalist countenance of Adam Schiff, who represents West Hollywood to the eastern border of Pasadena and Echo Park to the Angeles National Forest. Jimmy Dore and his wife, Steph Zamorano, live in Pasadena, and Steph has suggested suing Schiff for neglecting his constituents to lead the former communist crusade on the national stage. On Meet the Press, Bernie Sanders said that everybody knows the Republicans are trying to sabotage the 2018 midterms. Seemed like he actually made a little slip on the air there. He probably meant the Russians, although he said the Republicans because he went on to further accuse the Russians. That comes from the article, Anti-Trump, Anti-Russian Fundamentalism, The Reckless Resistance, by Ann Garrison, posted February 22nd. The book primarily investigates the official reports about Operation Cast Lead from 2008 to 2009, the Mavi Marmara from 2010, and Operation Protective Edge from 2014. Finkelstein attributes these assaults in part to Israel's intention to prove its deterrence capacity after its defeat by Hezbollah in 2006. A pattern emerges of Israel's surreptitious propagations that conceal its own aggression, use of disproportionate military force and targeting of civilians, specious legality, and lies that exonerate Israel and permit ever-increasing brutality. The Dahiya Doctrine refers to Israel's military strategy of acting immediately, decisively, and with disproportionate force. Dahiya is a suburb of Beirut that was flattened by Israel in the 2006 war. That comes from the article, Gaza, Who or What Has a Right to Exist, by Judith Deutsch, posted February 22nd, originally appearing at The Bullet. The Olympics, as well as the bilateral negotiations, provide an opportunity to eventually repeal the Combined Forces Command. What is needed is a mass movement supportive of a government decision to unilaterally withdraw all ROK forces from the Combined Forces Command, namely a unilateral repeal of the CFC, which extends to 2025, signed in 2014 on the orders of Washington by President Park Geun-hye, who was subsequently impeached. The objective is to reinstate President Moon as commander-in-chief of ROK forces as a means to achieving peace. This means that if the U.S. still wants to attack the DPRK, it will not be able to rely on ROK forces. And historically, the U.S. has always relied on its allies to do the dirty work. I think that the U.S. will do its utmost to sabotage the North-South dialogue while maintaining the Combined Forces Command intact. That comes from the text of Michel Chalcedovsky's February 21st presentation to the Republic of Korea National Assembly under the headline North Korea and the Dangers of Nuclear War, the Demilitarization of the Korean Peninsula Towards a Peace Agreement, posted February 22nd. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. While admitting that America has a long way to go in restoring equality and justice for its population of African descent, many are accustomed to thinking of the horrors of America's racist past as being mostly behind them. In 2018, America's legacy of white supremacy continues to pronounce itself through a number of systemic factors within the economic and so-called justice system. Joining us to discuss some of these factors is past guest Abayomi Azikiwe. He is editor of Pan-African Newswire and a frequent contributor to Global Research. Thank you for joining us, Abayomi.
Thank you for the invitation again.
Now, you've written and spoke of late about African Americans remaining the targets of a system of institutional racism and super exploitation. Most of us aren't used to thinking of the current system of policing and mass incarceration of black people as slavery by other means. Was this costume change a deliberate choice, or was it a consequence of unaddressed issues within American society?
I believe it is both. Of course, after the Civil War, between 1861 and 1865, there was an attempt by the United States Congress that was also generated by the necessity of reforming the Southern economic system of slavery that was tied to a system of capitalism that helped actually spawn the growth of monopoly capitalism. However, at the same time, the contradictions between the agriculturally based exploitative system and the more industrially oriented system reached a point of confrontation after 1860. However, with the abandonment of the South by the federal government after 1876, there was, of course, an effort by the white slaveocracy to reimpose a system of super exploitation in the southern part of the United States primarily. And what they did was the passage of a series of laws commonly known as the Black Codes. Then there was a number of federal court decisions and Supreme Court decisions, for example, the Slaughterhouse case of 1873. Later, there was the Plessy versus Ferguson case of 1896. Both of these Supreme Court decisions actually nullified the equal protection clauses of the 14th Amendment, the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. And then, of course, there was an effort to reimpose slave labor. This was done as well through the criminal justice system. There was the slavery by any other name, which was a title of a book and a documentary film that was done by Douglas Blackman. And of course, there was a documentary film done by the public broadcasting system in the United States, which it illustrates very clearly that vagrancy laws and other forms of trumped-up charges were used to frame African Americans, to sentence them to long terms in prison, and then to use their labor while they were in prison to build agricultural developments, to expand industrialism in the South. And, of course, this was done as well through a method of racial profiling, where African Americans became targets of this. Now, this could easily be upheld legally as the Southern ruling class rationalized through the 13th Amendment. We think of the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution that was passed in 1865 as an amendment that outlawed and said that slavery was unconstitutional. Nonetheless, in the first section of the 13th Amendment, it says that involuntary servitude is illegal, although it can be carried out when people are serving prison sentences for crimes that they have been convicted of. So they really had a legal rationale for carrying on this system of super exploitation. So we had a nullification of the 14th Amendment, which was passed in 1868, and then there was the 13th Amendment, which was passed in 1865. And, of course, these two constitutional amendments were basically ignored all the way up until the 1950s and 1960s in the United States. Mm.
Another development through history is this what's become the National Rifle Association, and this insistence on protecting firearms and people protecting themselves from a violent state or whatever. But it seems to me that just looking at the way Black Americans have been historically treated, it seems like if there's one group of people that would be most deserving of that consideration of arming themselves to protect themselves from a violent state, it would be Blacks. So if the NRA, I mean, I typically only seem to see white faces within the NRA, but could you maybe explain if the NRA, if there's like a racial or racist component to that whole entity?
I believe it is. I strongly believe that the Trump administration, the National Rifle Association, the Conservative Political Action Committee, CPAC, who was holding its national conference earlier this week, they have a conception of the right to bear arms, which, in my opinion, harks back to the founding of the Ku Klux Klan in 1866, the notion that white men in particular have some inherent right to rule the institutions and the economic means of production inside the United States. This is all it means, and that's why the National Rifle Association is dominated by a white male conservative. This phenomena, of course, is intersecting with the widespread mass shootings that are taking place in the United States. Even though the U.S. prides itself as being a democracy, as being a stable country politically and socially, the situation on the ground is actually just the opposite. We've seen so many mass shootings over the last year, particularly over the last several months. What happened in Las Vegas, where one man from a casino hotel had a tremendous arsenal, which he utilized to open fire on people at a country and western concert, killing dozens and wounding several hundred people. We also saw a former U.S. military soldier go into a small church in Texas and massacre dozens of people as well and injuring many more. Of course, the incident that took place in South Florida just a week ago is another case in point. Yet, we have the National Rifle Association, CPAC, and the Trump administration are arguing against any form of gun control. And I think they are operating, particularly the NRA, as a somewhat lobby for the gun manufacturers here in the United States. That's one of the major industries in the U.S., and that is the manufacture of firearms. Now, the question about firearms is very interesting because when groups like the Black Panther Party, for example, in the Republic of New Africa in the 1960s armed themselves against racist violence and violence by the state, most of the conservatives in the United States were against it. They sided with law enforcement. They sided with the FBI and the federal government, the Johnson administration, the Nixon administration, against these African-American youth who found it necessary to take up arms against state repression and racist violence. So it's a contradiction in that regard. On the one hand, they say that the Second Amendment should be upheld, but when oppressed people utilize that same constitutional law, whether it's the Second Amendment, whether it's the 13th Amendment or the 14th Amendment or the 15th Amendment, then, of course, it cannot be applied. So this is clearly a power struggle that's taking place inside the United States between an ever-shrinking white majority and a expanding African-American, Latino, Middle Eastern, indigenous, expanding minority. And, of course, the demographics of the situation is quite striking. And I think Trump exemplifies that when he often speaks about illegal immigration, getting rid of undocumented workers, and other issues related to people who are not of European descent, who are residents and citizens of the United States.
You know, typically when we hear people like, you know, liberals trying to, you know, to end racism, I think it's often depicted as an artifact of ignorance. And I think that's a mistake because it underestimates the level of sophistication that goes into perpetuating these systemic racism, and that there are certain economic benefits to a portion of the population. Not just, you know, people, you know, whites who feel that they're not able to get their jobs or whatever. I'm wondering if you could maybe, you know, expand a little bit on this idea of certain elite interests and how they profit literally from the perpetuation of racism.
Yes, this is a key component to the ruling apparatus in the United States. It has been since the conclusion of the Civil War. A lot of the programs and policies that were advocated by African-American political officials during the Reconstruction period, during the post-Civil War, from the 1860s through the 1870s, and even on a state and local level through the 1880s and 1890s, these policies actually benefited whites as well. They benefited working people and poor people in general, but it became necessary in order to fortify a white supremacist ruling capitalist exploitative system was to divide poor white, working class white from poor blacks and working class blacks on a racial basis. And that still exists today. We see how Trump, during the 2016 campaign, appealed to the white working class by saying that he was going to reopen the coal mines, he was going to reopen factories, he was going to stop jobs from being outsourced to Mexico and to China and other areas where countries are dominated by non-Europeans. This was his appeal to a broad sections of the white population. He won over a significant number of them in order to secure an electoral college victory in 2016, even though he lost the popular vote. So he's continuing to do this. If you listen to his speech that was done on February 23rd at the CPAC conference, he's making the same appeal, saying that if the Democrats take over the Congress during the midterm elections, which is scheduled to take place later on this year, that you'll have socialism, you'll have a denial of your Second Amendment rights, which is a right to bear arms for white people. He also goes on to say that the Democrats will repeal the tax cut in which he imposed. Now, this tax cut is really a form of austerity being launched against the majority of people inside the United States, not only the poor and the working class, but also the middle class as well. So he wants to, in effect, continue this division between black people and white people, the masses of black people and white people inside the United States, because it benefits his interests, it benefits the interests of Wall Street. Now, we've seen the volatility on Wall Street, the escalation of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the NASDAQ, and so forth. Yet at the same time, when there's an announcement about a potential rise in interest rates or a rise in income, of course, the stock market goes down. And he, of course, in his tax bill that was ratified by the Republican-dominated Senate and House, reducing the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%. Of course, in doing this, he creates a situation where the wealthiest corporations and individuals in U.S. society and throughout the world, in fact, feel confident about their future, that they will experience huge profits and huge privileges at the expense of working class people and poor people inside the United States.
You've commented on this show before, and a little bit in this show, about how the racist project and the project of capitalism are somehow linked, that you can't really get rid of racism without ultimately subverting capitalism. Could you maybe suggest what a joint anti-racist, anti-capitalist project would look like?
Yes, it would have to, of course, deal with the super exploitation of African Americans, of people of Latin American descent inside the United States. It would have to support a drastic increase in the minimum wage. It would have to require a guaranteed annual income, national health insurance, which we do not have in the United States, even though just right across the border in Canada, there is national health insurance. Somehow, the United States feels, the rulers of the United States feels, that it would destroy the health care system to guarantee everyone who is a citizen and resident of the United States full health coverage benefit. It would guarantee full employment. Now, these are some of the same demands that Dr. Martin Luther King was advancing 50 years ago at the time of his assassination. He was attempting to organize a poor people's campaign when he stopped off in Memphis, Tennessee to support a African-American sanitation worker strike demanding recognition and a living wage. He was assassinated on April 4th of 1968. However, he wanted these same demands that still remain with us today, as I mentioned earlier. The need for full employment, a guaranteed annual income, national health insurance, the rebuilding of the central cities in regard to decent housing. And today, of course, we have a greater consciousness about environmental justice, to fight against ecological degradation, which is widespread throughout the urban areas inside the United States. So, yes, Dr. King, 50 years ago, drew the link between imperialist war that was taking place in Vietnam. He also said it was necessary to end poverty as well as racism. So these issues are still with us today, some 5 decades later.
I was wondering if you could also, because you're alluding to Martin Luther King, and I know that his image has been somewhat sanitized over the years. I mean, we don't, in the retrospectives, we don't hear so much about that more radical King, if you will. And, of course, there are other images of black people in the media about being violent or ignorant or what have you. I was wondering if you could possibly comment on the role that you see media playing currently and in continuing to foster those racial divisions, even in spite of what might be considered more uplifting movies like the current Black Panther movie?
There's a situation where for decades the corporate media has tried to sanitize the image of Dr. Martin Luther King, the civil rights movement, and the African-American movement in general. Dr. King was killed with the complicity of the federal government. The FBI had tens of thousands of files on him and the civil rights movement during the 1960s. And J. Edgar Hoover was by no means a supporter of civil rights, equal justice, and self-determination for the African-American people. Today, we have a similar situation. 50 years ago, there was the counterintelligence program, Black Nationalist Hate Group Project. There was the Key Black Extremist Index, which targeted key African-American activists for destabilization and discrediting. Today, the FBI just last year issued a Black Identity Extremist Index saying that somehow people who are out demonstrating against racism are a threat to law enforcement and the status quo. So this is a continual process, and of course this is something that people need to be conscious of inside this country, and as well as internationally. The United States tries to pride itself as being a paragon for civil rights and human rights, when in fact today African Americans, Latinos, Middle Eastern communities, indigenous communities are still subjected to national oppression and institutionalized racism.
Well, Bayoume Ezekiwe, I wish we had more time, but I think we'll have to let you go. But I want to thank you very much for sharing these important insights with us, especially during this important month.
Thank you so much, and keep up the good work.
Okay, will do. We've been joined by Abayomi Azikiwe. He is the editor of Pan-African Newswire and a frequent contributor to Global Research. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Jamaican-born Dr. Afua Cooper is associate professor at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada. She holds the James Robinson Johnston Chair in Black Canadian Studies and is celebrated as an award-winning poet, author, historian, curator, performer, cultural worker, and recording artist. Afua holds a PhD in history with specialties in slavery, abolition, and women's studies, and is one of Canada's premier experts and chroniclers of the country's black past. She joins us now by phone. Welcome, Professor Cooper.
Thank you.
It strikes me that Canadians tend to sanitize their own history of racism and hold up their country as some sort of benevolent model of virtue in the world. I mean, the country is only recently, it seems, coming to terms with its injustices towards Indigenous peoples with regard to residential schools, dislocation and such. With regard to the history of blacks on the North American continent, Canadians typically forget its own history of slavery, focusing instead on Canada as the promised land in the era of the Underground Railroad. How critical was the slave trade to the Canadian economy and Canadian society in the 18th century?
How critical was it?
Yeah, for the economy and society.
Thank you. Well, I would answer the question by saying that under both the colonial, both the French and the English colonial regimes, and the enslavement of Africans was an established institution. So during the French period, the first, we would say Canada's first black slave, Olivier Lejeune, arrived here in 1628. By the time the 17th century matured, you find blacks coming from all over the world to what we could call Quebec, being held in the status of the enslaved. When Canada was conquered by Britain in 1760, in fact, the enslavement of Africans intensified, as by then Britain was the largest slave trading empire on the planet. So all throughout our older colonies, the five older colonies, you know, from the planter period, the planters coming from New England to Maritimes, Canada, even among the Acadians before they were banned from Canada or expelled from Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, the Acadians also held slaves. And certainly during the Loyalist dispensation, we hear about the free black Loyalists, but there at least 1,500 enslaved black Loyalists came up to Canada. All throughout, we have this history of slavery. Now that we know that on the Eastern Canadian front, merchants from Halifax and other places on the east were involved in the West India trade. This was before the abolition of British slavery in 1833. And merchants from Eastern Canada helped to support slavery's infrastructure in the Caribbean by sending down the pickled meats, the salted cod, the flour, the timber, the horses, and so on to support slavery in the Caribbean. And in reverse, the slave planters, the slave owners of the Caribbean, sent up the rum and the sugar and the molasses that would grace the table of everyone in the five older colonies, from the governor right down to the humblest yeoman farmer. People were consuming slave-grown products. So it's not only just within Canada where you have homegrown slavery, but Canadian provinces were also involved in the Atlantic trade from the Caribbean. That was the British Caribbean, French Caribbean, or Spanish Caribbean. And that history has been covered up.
Mm. Now, slavery did not come to an end in Canada all in one day. And as I understand it, the government's compensation of slave owners was more generous than that of the slaves themselves. What was the historical fallout of that flawed process?
Yes, quite so. I mean, there were sort of several and different abolitions within the five older colonies. And for the listeners, when I'm talking about the five older colonies, I'm talking about today what we call Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, Ontario, and Quebec. These are kind of the originary spaces of the colonies that eventually became the core of the Canadian nation state, the Canadian settler state. So finally, in 1833, the British Parliament passed an act to abolish the enslavement of Africans within the British colonies. And within Canada, what we call Canada, as I just explained, several enslaved people got their freedom. But when we are looking at the slavery's compensation, the British government compensated slave owners. And when we're looking at who received what, it's interesting because a British historian by the name of Nicholas Draper has written this book about compensation. And we see that business people in Canada, including the family of the wife, of the second wife of Sir John A. Macdonald, received compensation. The wife of Sir John A. Macdonald, his second wife, came from a Jamaican landed class, and her family owned 75 slaves. And so when slavery was abolished, her family got several thousand pounds for the loss of their property. And Michael, the enslaved people who had labored for over 250 years for free, had their life, their labor, and their children stolen, did not receive 1 cent from the British government. So, you know, Sir John's family is one. We have Mather Bales Allman, who was a governor of Dalhousie University and also of King's College in Halifax. He received compensation money from two slave plantations in Jamaica. It's as we do this work, we're uncovering the links, the colonial links between the different colonies and between the ruling class in each colony, the ruling class in Nova Scotia, the ruling class in Quebec, with the ruling classes. These are the slaveocracy, the slave owners in Jamaica and Antigua and so forth.
I know that when I first interviewed you, I first had a chance to hear you speak. You'd just written the book, The Hanging of Angelique, the story of a Portuguese woman Portuguese-born woman who's a slave to a widow in old Montreal. She was subjected to what resembles, to my mind anyway, a witch trial, tortured and hanged on the charge of burning down her mistress's house and subsequently 45 other buildings, which she denied until broken under torture. Can you help us understand the context of this trial and why authorities went to such extreme and inhumane lengths to see her prosecuted?
Yes. So we're still, with that trial, we're still in the French period. And the French system of justice was inquisitorial, meaning you're guilty until proven innocent. And so they come at you. You have to prove you're innocent. And you have to prove your innocence through your words. You have to have, like, great verbal skills. So the judges were there. They said they accused Angélique of burning down her mistress's house, which led to a big fire in what we now call Old Montreal. She denied it. So eventually she was tortured. She broke under torture. She confessed to setting the fire. And her sentence was that she was going to be burnt alive. They did reduce or modify the sentence to hanging. So they were going to hang her first and then burn her body, which is what they did. So it's the context of French justice, which is inquisitorial. And they come up with a guilty verdict, even if you're innocent. The fact that Angélique was an enslaved woman meant that she was a social outcast. She had no support from anyone. She was a victim. She had no family. No one. She was literally out there alone in the world. She was not a free woman. She was not a white woman. Because we know, murder is also a capital offense, meaning punishable by death. And around the time now, a white woman had killed her husband, but she was exiled from the colony. They didn't hang her. She was exiled. But, you know, Angélique's status certainly played a role in how she was treated and the gruesome and the awful sentence that that was carried out upon her body.
Hmm. Now, moving up to the early 20th century, I know that black people from the American South answered the call, along with Europeans, to settle the prairies as farmers and homesteaders. But this wave of immigration was very brief. Could you talk about some of the resistance they encountered from their neighbors and from Canadian authorities?
Absolutely. So one may ask, well, okay, that was slavery, that was then. What does that have to do with us now? And one of the things I always like to talk about is the legacies of slavery, the legacies, the aftermath, the afterlife. So when these African-American farmers answered the call, as you rightly put it, the Canadian government was settling the prairies, and these African-American farmers, they were farmers, they knew how to do prairie farming, they were coming from Oklahoma, Nebraska, and, you know, all those Kansas, all those cold places. They were Christians, they spoke English, they had money. So, in theory, they were perfect settlers, except the Canadian government did not want blacks. As we confederated in 1867, the country was conceptualized as a white man's country. You look at the immigration documents, they said this country is for the sons of the white race, right? So they saw the American blacks through the lens of slavery. All across the prairies in your province, Manitoba, there was this hysteria that if black people, especially black men, came up, they're going to ravish white women. So you have this intersection of race, gender, sexuality, and it was sort of all cast on the body of the black man as this rapist. Right, so there was this hysteria against these, you know, God-fearing, decent black people coming from America. They were not wanted because Canada was conceptualized as a white space. And so the Dominion government or the federal government passed an order in council to ban black migration. So many petitions, Edmonton Board of Trade, the Winnipeg Board of Trade, all these various business organizations petitioned the federal government to stop black migration. And under Laurier, Prime Minister Laurier, the Liberal government, and later Borden, that's exactly what happened. So it was very brief. These African and Americans were turned away at the border. They even sent recruiting agents down to Texas and Oklahoma to tell the people not to come. They said, Canada is so cold, you won't withstand it. Everything freezes in the ground. You will not be able to survive in Canada. You know, meanwhile, these people are living in Kansas. So that was the kind of racism that the federal government carried out towards the black community.
Yeah, you're talking about this legacy of slavery, and today no politician in Canada would express outright racism toward black people, but that does not necessarily mean systemic barriers have gone away. Could you address the systemic and institutional barriers and trends that you see enduring to this day?
I want to look at one, maybe two examples. And the first one is who is wanted in Canada. Even up until this day, who is wanted? And it's certainly not the black body. Here's why. There are only 4 immigration offices that issue resident visas to Africans on the continent of Africa. The continent of Africa is huge, as you know, over 1 billion people. Canada only has 4 visa offices on the entire continent. So if you are in Sierra Leone and someone sponsors you or you're trying to get a visa, you have to go to Senegal or Ghana for that, because in those 2 places there are immigration offices, which means you have to buy a plane ticket or travel by road. You have to find money for a hotel. You have to find money for food. And heaven forbid if you have children and, you know, and a spouse, so, you know, which brings up the cost. When you look at, there are 16 immigration offices, if you want to compare that to another place, in Hong Kong, 16. So it's clear that Canada still does not want black people as immigrants coming in. The focus is now on certain Asian countries. I think they have given up on Europe because Europeans just don't migrate. There's no need for them to migrate anymore. So that's one example. The second example is when you look at some of the main cities in Canada, the larger cities, I should say, or let me put another way, the cities where you have big black populations like Toronto, Halifax, Montreal, Hamilton, and so on. You find blacks are incarcerated at a higher rate, higher rates in arrest statistics. Black children, at least 40% in my city of Halifax, where I live. Toronto, certainly, dropping out of school. You see these systemic forms of racial discrimination against the black community. Toronto only has 8% black people. 42% of the children in foster care are African-Canadian children. So there's something going on, and this has been going on for years. We have report after report, the Stephen Lewis report in 1992, several after that, so many. They talk about the same thing, the systemic barriers, the structural barriers. And what we see is governments dragging their legs in addressing some of these issues. And so from the time of slavery to present time, we have this extreme discrimination against black people in this country. At the end of January, January 28th this year, we saw Prime Minister Justin Trudeau talking about the United Nations Decade for the People of African Descent and talking about discrimination against black people in Canada. I mean, I looked at him and he said it. He said we have to do better. But you're looking at some of these forms of discrimination. I'm sure this can resonate with you, Michael, as a journalist. But after the Prime Minister gave his talk about the decade and how discrimination against black people in Canada must end, when the journalists asked him questions, they did not ask him one question about the press conference he gave. They asked about sexual harassment in the parliament, nothing about what he called the press conference for. It was simply astounding.
Yes.
Simply astounding. So the media, as if to say, well, Justin, you have talked about discrimination of blacks. We're not interested in that. And we're going to show you we're not interested. We won't ask you any question on that.
Which brings
up. I think the Prime Minister, after the third irrelevant question, should have said, look, guys, I made this press conference. I've issued this press release. What is your response to it? But nothing.
Afua Cooper, I thank you for joining me during Black History Month. I wish we had more time, but thanks for giving our listeners a taste of the myths and realities of the Black experience in Canada. All the best.
The pleasure was mine, Michael.
We've been joined by award-winning poet, author, historian, and recording artist, Dalhousie University professor Afua Cooper. Before we close this episode of the show, we wanted to bring you an update in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, widely seen as a political prisoner and a symptom of the racism inherent within America's so-called justice system. Initially arrested in 1981 and placed on death row in the killing of a Philadelphia police officer, Mumia was subjected to significant irregularities in his case. Thanks in large part to an international campaign, Mumia was successfully removed from death row but now is serving a life sentence. There has been a recent call to action on Mumia's behalf. Suzanne Ross, a representative of the International Concern Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal, joined us recently to share the details.
We just put out a call beginning of December around the world, asking people to endorse two demands. One is the demand that all the records, police and district attorney records, relevant to Mumia's case, but specifically to the conflict of interest involved in one individual who happened to have been involved in the district attorney's office and played a role in prosecution of the case back in the early 80s, and then, lo and behold, became a Supreme Court justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court and got to rule on his own ruling. In other words, he got to decide whether Mumia's appeal for all the decisions that were made in the original prosecution of his case that found him guilty and warranting a death sentence, this case then came up before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and a key person that was involved in the prosecution now got to be the person, one of the people, reviewing the case.
That would be Ronald Castile.
And that was Ronald Castile. Ronald Castile is one of the really, really critical, horrible individuals. Politically, I don't know him, of course. Politically horrible, pro-death penalty, pro-mass incarceration, pro-unlimited rights to police. And he got to almost single-handedly play a role in the original prosecution of Mumia in the lower court of Pennsylvania, in the Philadelphia court, the Court of Common Pleas, it's called. He got to play a key role in that, then got to play a key role in the state Supreme Court, and, of course, was out to kill Mumia. He campaigned against Mumia. He was, by the way, very close to the Fraternal Order of Police. He was named Man of the Year by the Fraternal Order of Police, which is, for those who might think it's a union, it's not a union. It's basically a criminal body of policemen who've hung together to, and many of them have been convicted over time of criminality. Many of these policemen have been on numerous cases. In fact, all the policemen who were at the scene of the so-called crime where Mumia was nearly beaten, nearly killed by the police, and where a policeman was killed in that scene. But at that original scene, the police officer in charge of the whole operation, the policemen there, were all indicted later and convicted for some kind of corruption, for different kinds of corruption, perhaps. So This is the operation that convicted Mumia, that locked him up, that sentenced to death, that tried to kill him twice through legal means, once through medical malpractice, and now there's a chance that this case could be opened up. That's what this coming March 27th in the Court of Common Pleas in Philadelphia is going to review the issue of the, well, first we have to force the district attorney's office to turn over the records that the police and the district attorney's office have that show the relationship between Ronald Castile and Mumia's conviction. In other words, they're saying now that Ronald Castile played a very minor role in this whole case. Well, we know that's absurd. That's absurd. A man who believes in the death penalty, a man who supports the police unequivocally, who is determined to continue the death penalty, and who has been actively involved in fighting for the execution of so many of the prisoners who've come up before him. You mean this guy does not care and sat back quietly and silently while the most famous political prisoner in the country, one of the most famous political prisoners in the world, who was sentenced to death when that case was before him, he sat back quietly? Absurd, right? We know that's absurd. And so we have to get these. We are sure that the conspiracy to kill Mumia, to execute him, and now he's off death row, of course, but has been sentenced to life with prison without any opportunity for parole. And we know that that kind of life in prison without any opportunity for parole is really a slow death penalty.
Could you talk about what he's experiencing now? He does have some health problems, as I understand it.
Yes, he does. So he let me just go back, because I jumped around a little. So let me just go back and review one thing, and then I'll tell you about the health, his health situation, which is that I was saying that back in early December, we put out a call for people to endorse the demand, support the demand for one, releasing all these records that I'm talking about that could lead to Mumia's ultimate freedom, and two, that Mumia be released now because he's innocent, because he's sick, because they have nearly killed him, because they have denied him all kinds of due process, et cetera, et cetera. So this is the campaign. With that, those two demands, we have had people sign that, so people have endorsed that call from all over the world. 15 members of the Danish Parliament, 15 members of the Danish Parliament signed that. People like, of course, Cornel West, Angela Davis, you know, Danny Glover, all those kinds of people. Unions, major unions in the United States, a major union in Japan, in Australia, in France. The response has been mind-blowing. So when I say Mumia's case is so important to people and that 36 years later people are still supporting him, I'm saying that off this response that I happen to coordinate this signing, this petition, this letter, it's called an international letter, that the response was way beyond what we expected. 15 members of the Danish Parliament, we hadn't heard or talked with them for years. And still people remember Mumia and say, this case is very, very important to us. So now let me answer your question about his health, okay?
Sure.
All right. So Mumia was very sick, nearly died from medical malpractice a little more than 2 years ago, and then was diagnosed by a doctor that we brought in who could only see Mumia in the waiting room. He was not given medical privileges, but he came, examined Mumia's skin, looked at his symptoms, looked at the blood records and all that, and said Mumia had hepatitis C and that he was suffering from all the side effects and so on of hepatitis C. And we began a campaign to get Mumia the cure for hepatitis C, which is now available. There's a drug that really cures people and seems to have little of no or no side effects. So after a two-year battle where the Department of Corrections in Pennsylvania refused to give him this drug, we finally forced them through the courts and through us testifying in court. I myself testified as a friend. Others testified. This doctor who consulted, he was the key witness, really, saying he is going to die of this illness if he's not treated. He needs this drug. And the judge ordered the Department of Corrections to immediately grant that drug. And lo and behold, he got it. And lo and behold, he got cured of hepatitis C. Unfortunately, the vestige of having had hepatitis C for as long as he had, probably about more than 20 years, I think, because he had gotten when he was originally nearly killed, and he had to have blood transfusions in the hospital. In other words, the system gave him hepatitis C with the blood transfusion, which he no doubt needed, but they didn't even check on the blood, clear it adequately, and even follow up on the possibility that he had hepatitis C. At any rate, he has now been left with cirrhosis of the liver. It's not super advanced. We're not sure whether that's what's accounting for his horrible itching, painful, painful itching throughout across his body, his whole body. And the medications they were giving him were not adequate. We've asked for him to be transferred to a hospital. They haven't done that. And they're giving him a new drug now, which we'll have to see if it works. It takes 2 or 3 months for that drug to kick in. In the meantime, they give him various palliative things, which are helping a little, but he's still suffering a lot. So that is Mumia's current health condition. So we're saying, on top of his innocence, you know, they owe him the release because they're not treating him. They got him sick. They nearly killed him. And enough is enough. Release Mumia now.
Mumia's next court hearing is March 27th. The campaign to free Mumia Abu-Jamal is issuing a call for international demonstrations, protests, and events coinciding with that date, and to come to the courthouse on that date to show their support. For more details, please visit www.freemumia.com. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com.